This week's show is brought to you by Severn Films, their new release Threads, available as of January 30th. The movie that shook the world, restored in HD for the first time ever. In September 1984, it was aired on the BBC and shocked tens of millions of UK viewers. 4 months later, it was broadcast in America and became the most watched basic cable program in history. After more than three decades, it remains one of the most acclaimed and shattering made-for-television movies of all time. Rhys Dinsdale, David Bearley, and Karen Meagher star in this graphic and haunting docudrama about the effects of a nuclear attack on the working-class city of Sheffield, England, as the fabric of society unravels. Directed by Mick Jackson from a screenplay by novelist-playwright Barry Hines, and nominated for 7 BAFTA Awards, the most terrifying and honest portrayal of nuclear war ever filmed has now been fully restored from a 2K scan for the first time ever. Available January 30th from Severn Films, check them out online at www.severn-films.com.
Today's episode is also brought to you by Shudder. Brought to you by AMC Network, Shudder is not only a premium streaming video service, but an experience unlike any other. Created for fans of all degrees of thrillers, suspense, and horror, Shudder is the home to the largest and fastest-growing human-curated selection of high-quality, spine-tingling, and provocative films, television series, and originals. There's always something new and unexpected for Shudder members to explore. Premiering exclusively on Shudder this week is the film Don't Grow Up. On an isolated island, a group of teenage delinquents living in a youth center wake up to find themselves alone with no one to watch over them. They realize the island has been deserted, or practically deserted. A few adults they encounter on their journey all seem to be infected by a mysterious epidemic, making them violent and dangerous. Best described as Skins meets 28 Days Later, Don't Grow Up is a tense story of oncoming adulthood reminiscent of John Carpenter. Shudder is available for $4.99 a month or $49.99 for an annual membership. But our listeners can get a free month by entering the promo code SHOCK at checkout. Go to Shudder.com today and find the best collection of thrillers, suspense, and horror available to stream anywhere. Promo code SHOCK for a free month.
Hey guys, Shockwaves is going to Texas Frightmare 2018. This year's convention is the 13th anniversary of this epic con. It's taking place May 4th, 5th, and 6th at the Dallas-Fort Worth Hyatt, and you don't want to miss it. Just announced Paranormal Activity's Katie Featherstone will be joining. We have met her. She was at Jump Cut Cafe back in the day, super cute and all, seemed like a really cool person. Other guests include Clive Barker and several of the Cenobites, Doug Bradley, Matt Lillard, Stephen Weber, Tobin Bell, Shawnee Smith from The Blob, Robin Perlman, Darren Lynn Bousman, Ethan Embry from Devil's Candy, and many more. Don't wait to get your passes. Go to TexasFrightmareWeekend.com and we will see you in Texas. Touch us on our face!
Do not touch my face.
That is going to be
our
tagline.
Do not touch my face.
You can come touch my face.
You can touch Elric's face.
Okay, and welcome to episode 81 of Shockwaves. I'm your host, Rob G. Sitting with me is Mr. Elric Kane.
What's up?
I love your Mind's Eye t-shirt, by the way.
Oh, cold Bigus reference.
It says this film should be played loud. That's what that is, right?
I'm fairly sure that's some Driller killer action there.
Oh.
Man, Becca's showing Rob a big time. Rob hasn't seen any movies pre-90s.
I own the Driller killer now on Blu-ray. Right. I even have the Badgerous commentary that he did on the original DVD.
I held on to that. But do you also own Mind's Eye? Do you?
Anyways, also with us is Becca McKendry is back. We're down a Ryan Turk and up a Becca McKendry.
What up, guys? I used to have this dream in New York City that someday I would be walking through a thrift store and I would happen upon that buffalo painting from Driller Killer.
Isn't it in the Library of Congress now?
Are you fucking serious?
No, I'm not even kidding. Somebody said this last year that painting is in like Washington, D.C. in the like Library of Congress.
It's like a buffalo with a weird eye and laser beams behind
I wish I knew who said that.
Someone,
we have to research that. If you know this factoid, because it definitely came up on our show with a guest at some point.
Where is the buffalo painting from Driller Killer? Yeah.
I wonder if our guest will know later. He seems like the kind of guy that would know that information.
Hey, guys, I have a pop quiz for you guys.
Oh, no.
Oh,
hey,
dear.
Where was I last week?
You went to a show with your family that you had tickets for.
Okay, Rob passes. You're Kane, sick. You You're suck. Sick.
I
you
saw you on the weekend.
Time.
We marched for, I know. For the betterment of mankind I know. Together, and I still
which
don't know
I didn't know
were.
About that you yeah. guys were going to do that. I would have considered joining.
I don't think
you,
we really
maybe.
Planned to do it together, but it was a kid thing.
Yeah, it was like cool. You know, we wanted the kids to march
to
for
not
women's
get
rights
crushed by downtown people,
and yeah. so we went. Yeah, I was like, as I really wanted to take Marnie, but then they were estimating 400,000 people were going to show up in yeah. downtown Los Angeles, and I was like, not where I want to take my 4-year-old and my 2-year-old. Yeah. So we went to the Burbank one. Which was really nice. Okay. And the police officers were really nice.
And I had a great moment where my 3-year-old, he goes, "This is what democracy looks like." And he looks up at me and goes, "What's democracy?" And I really had no idea how to explain it to him.
My daughter asked me why we hate certain people so much, because some of the chants.
Why are you so hateful?
I know. But she was asking me that. She was like, because some of the chants were very anti certain politicians.
Oh.
And so she was like, "Mom, why do we hate this person?" And yeah, it was.
This person happened to be the president of the United
States. He may. And so, but we still.
What
a
predicament.
We marched for women's rights.
What a predicament our country's gotten itself into.
And we met a total horror fan while we were standing there waiting to march. There was this guy who was like,
oh, yeah.
Because Elric.
What was he wearing? A St. Kiwanis t-shirt. Not the thing. It was something.
Yeah, it was like the fog or something. Yeah, he had like a carpenter shirt. It was aliens. He had Ripley on.
Ripley.
But he noticed Elric's, instead of wearing the traditional, like pink pussy hat that you wear to the marches. Elric had a greasy strangler hat on.
Oh, nice. Turn backwards.
Hey,
so no one knows.
Good improv.
Yeah. So he was like, "Is that a greasy strangler hat?" And then we met a horror fan.
Wow.
It was awesome.
And we tried to turn him onto our show.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
We did try.
We did. We were like, we host a podcast.
So it was somewhat
shameless. If you like us here, you'll like us on air.
Always working, man. Always working.
Always working it. Well, that's cool. Let's do a little bit of news really quick, because I honestly haven't seen that much. First and foremost, a couple weeks ago, we had Mick Garris on the show. Postmortem with Mick Garris is now part of the Blumhouse Podcast Network. He posted some pictures with Mr. John Carpenter, who's going to be on episode 1. I know Elric's very jealous.
I wanted to be his assistant on that.
We will have John on at some point, I'm sure. But he is the first guest on Mick's show, which debuts February 14th. That's correct. And this gives me an opportunity to give a shout-out to our sound engineer who doesn't get enough credit, Ernie, who's sitting here patiently every week listening to us talk about horror nonstop. And not to put you on the spot, but I texted him, "How did it go with John Carpenter?" And he said, "I yawned and he stopped the whole podcast."
That is the most Carpenter thing.
Is totally.
Ever.
He's like, "What, am I boring you? What's going on here?" So I don't think that's going to be in the episode, but just a little behind the scenes for you there. Nice. So there's that.
That's exciting.
Let's see what else. I wanted to mention, again, somewhat shameless, but thank you to the response, everybody, last week regarding Dread Center Presents and the screenings and some of the films we're doing. I'm very excited because we just announced that we are, in fact, releasing this summer To Hell and Back, the Kane Hodder story.
Oh, cool.
And it was very important to me from the get-go. Basically, from day one, I was negotiating that film because I knew I wanted to have different types of movies. Yeah. So there's gothic horror, there's a slasher, there's art house sci-fi, and now we have a documentary. I know Ryan talked about it when he initially saw it. It's really great. Beyond just being a fan of Kane, it just as a documentary, it's just a really good story, and I'm really looking forward to putting that out into the world come this summer.
It'd be tremendous to have someone on to promote that film here.
I think we could do that.
I think we could handle that. Hey, guys, he's going to be at Texas Frightmare too.
Is he?
Uh-huh.
Oh,
yeah,
wow.
A bunch of the Jasons. I think quite a few different people who play Jason are meant to be there.
Interesting. Well, somebody requested trying to get this movie shown there, so I hear you. We will see. Maybe you'll get to see it early at
That's
Texas Frightmare if I can pull that off. What else? What else is going on in your worlds?
What about you, Becca?
Well, no news exactly, but I did have an amazing kind of more cerebral week because we lost cable. Like our internet went out for 6 days, like so much so that the cable company is like reimbursing us like 25% of our bill this month. So internet goes out for 6 days. It was weird because it was suddenly like the only time I've ever been like this is like when I'm driving and, road trips or things like that. And even then I would tether off my phone. Yeah. But I never realized, one, how much I do stream. Like literally, I am streaming constantly. Like everything I watch is on Hulu or Netflix or Amazon. And two, how much bullshit I watch. because I was trying to think, like literally during this time, I started going back through my DVDs and doing the, well, I've never seen this before. I guess I'll watch this tonight. I've never seen this. I guess I'll watch this tonight. So I watched a lot of weird shit this week, the stuff that I've never gotten around to. But then I was thinking, wow, I've watched like a movie a night for the entire time that the internet's been out. And then I was like, what do I usually watch? And the answer is bullshit. Like, I literally just float around and I'm like, well, this looks good. I'll watch an episode of this, now an episode of this. And so it was very weird to, it reminded me of college where I literally used to watch a movie a night just because there was, you know, nothing on TV that I was interested in. So yeah, it was kind of interesting to suddenly have to return to physical media.
I'm glad you had this moment of self-reflection.
Yeah, I was, thank you. Enlightenment. Thank you, Elric.
Yeah. You're more in touch with yourself.
We got the internet back and it was very refreshing. So yeah.
Nice.
But I'm telling you, man, don't deny the physical media. That's why I got a nice big wall. Just Blu-rays nonstop.
See, I parsed all mine down a couple of years ago because I watch everything on Amazon, and usually what I'm watching is based by what's available. And so I parsed down a lot of it a couple of years ago, but I've had it to watch shelf. I still keep that, like my blind buys, or I'm never going to find this on Amazon Prime. I'll keep on this shelf. So I worked my way through it.
Speaking of Amazon Prime, here's some news for you. Last week was Fright Night 2 in HD. You just posted about a movie, Elric, via Pure Cinema, or maybe it was Brian. Ten to Midnight.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Last night.
Oh, wow.
The Charles Bronson slasher movie, which was put out on Blu-ray by Twilight Time. I think it's still available, but if you have Amazon Prime, that is
such a fun movie, man.
The place to go see it. That is quite a movie.
Yeah, it's best. I would always say with a movie like that, like watch it first before you're buying it. You know, I think people will want to own it afterwards. But hey, watch it for free first. You know,
yeah.
Like why commit there?
All right. So,
More news.
Yes, hit us.
Get Out nominated for ton of Oscars.
Four Academy Awards.
But four doesn't sound like a lot, but when they're the four best awards, it's a lot.
Yeah.
I think
yeah.
they are the key awards. So that's super awesome. There's no movie I want to see win more than that. But also, a little shout out to listener, who one of our listeners has been is in one of the films nominated for a couple of the biggest Oscars.
Oh.
And me and you happen to watch Pieces with him. John Carna.
Oh,
congratulations,
get out.
Sir.
Wait, what the hell is he in?
He's in Lady Bird.
Oh, my gosh.
In a couple major scenes of Lady Bird, actually, and he's really good in it. You know, he's kind of background character work, but he's you know, featured. But anyway, and for those who don't know who he is, the kid from Scream.
Yeah.
That we talk about all the
back.
Time.
Yeah.
But anyway, I thought that was super cool because when I saw Lady Bird nominated, I was like, wait, that means John Carna's nominated. Hey, congrats,
John. That's really
John.
Cool.
So anyway, they just want to make sure we get a shout out to him. So make sure we're rooting for him. Good to see Greta Gerwig in the director's circle, too.
Wow.
That was
once had her face blown off in House of the Devil.
I know, isn't that cool? Yeah.
Oscar contender.
Yeah. Horror, man. Horror's still kicking, dude.
It's where it begins.
I'll tell you a movie that's not still kicking.
Oh, boy.
Horror's still kicking.
Hit us with it.
But I did it. I pushed the button on the Jigsaw.
I watched it too.
We did.
I did right. Up here.
Team. All right, gotta hear about it.
Let's talk some Jigsaw.
One of the notes says more of the same but less. then I have the note totally unremarkable. You know, like it's stylistic. Like I love these directors. I really like. My disappointment is less in the Saw movie because it's really just like the other movies. So it's not a problem of movies.
I don't know.
I'm disappointed in them. Like I'm like these guys made that freaking awesome Willem Dafoe, Ethan Hawke vampire
movie. Daybreakers. They made Predestination.
Yeah. So like I would have at least thought they would have like had. And now I don't know how much freedom they had on this project, but it's so in line with the problems of the Saw franchise rather than its strength. Like it still has some cool. Traps.
That's
but it.
It
doubles down on the bad plot stuff and
it
the cops and,
oh
and
my
double
God.
Crosses and you're like, oh, kill
it
me with the plot.
So
like,
much plot
ugh,
and
yeah.
cops and who could be involved and there was a lot of pipe in it.
And
it
utterly ludicrous pipe. Like plot stuff.
Like, and so like you could literally like there were plot holes that you could hurl a reverse bear trap through.
Yeah.
It was I mean like it
it's
was
better
pretty...
than the last movie. I really think
yes.
it's a much better film than the last one just because it, you know, it's slick, which is nice. But it's reinvention because it's trying to be more or less like another one, and it has a slight reinvention like it's trying to do for the future, and it just totally is not going to work.
Is it
not going to spawn more movies.
So is it not a satisfactory twist at the end? Because it seems like that's
no.
what these movies are built on.
No.
Is that?
Utterly no,
no,
in my opinion.
It's been done before. It wasn't anything new. It was kind of
yeah,
like...
Yeah, don't spoil
it.
Make sure we don't
yeah,
give
I'm
it away.
Yeah, I'm not going to spoil, but I will say you've seen this twist in some of the other films
yeah.
before, so it was just kind of like, oh, that was... I just assumed from the beginning that was what was going on because you've done that in two other films. Yeah, and there was a lot of cops. That was kind of
And that's always been the problem with the series. Like, I don't care about investigators and journalists and news reports. Like, no, put it, some kids in there and let them go for
the
it.
The things that I did like about it, it was kind of what I remember about the Saw series, especially some of the latter ones, is that they were just ugly and dirty. But you forget that sometimes the gore is kind of fun. Like, there's these great reveals when the guy's, you know, head gets chopped halfway. Yeah, and then you're like, oh, like, there's some fun gore in it. I did like, but they did not explore it in any capacity. They talk about how, because it's like 10 years since Jigsaw has died, that he has become like this cult phenomenon and that there's websites dedicated to him and people who are dedicated to looking at the traps.
How can they not?
And I'm like,
Cult of Saw would have been better.
Yeah, like, Cult if they went of all Saw in. Or if, you know, because they were talking about how there are people that collect the traps and try to rebuild them. And I'm like, dude,
that's
there's
your
plot
right there.
A more realistic
it's literally
treatment.
Like, yeah, it's like a passing
but
glance.
But see, if you did that, you'd want it to be set more in a real world where that was the fake thing, whereas this is in the, has the exact same level of artifice as the other movies, and it just – I don't know, it's a bummer. But that said, like, I feel like our generation had Friday 13th where we grew up, and there's a movie every year, and we kind of go back to them even when they're not great sometimes. I wonder if there's people who this will be enough for. Like, I think some people will be like, oh, no, it's still good because it's still Saw, and it's still ticking those boxes, and I'm happy. Like,
if I had been a 16-year-old just going to see this, I would have been like, cool traps, watched a girl get burned inside out from acid. Mm. I ate popcorn. It's pretty fun.
Yeah.
But yeah, as
and
a...
And also deeply, deeply unlikable characters.
Oh my God, no one like, was likable.
I don't, when I think about it, I don't think anyone has even the slightest charisma where you're like, yeah, I like that guy. They're just all unlikable. And that's always been one of the problems. Like when they – let me put it this way. This is the first time in my cinematic viewing history where I've thought to myself out loud, man, I miss Donnie Wahlberg. Like I've never had that thought until this movie.
And this one, not only do you have the cops, they also bring in these two coroner characters because I guess that they needed a female to be educated.
And because CSI is popular.
Yeah, and so they get this female coroner, but they make her oversexed and into fetishes. And you're like, so you
she's
have
– heavily tattooed.
Heavily – So you get one educated female in the movie, and she's just completely, like, devolved to this. Yeah. And it's just
– But again, I think the real waste is the Spirit Brothers because, like, you're like, oh, those guys are so visually inventive. I felt like there's a couple interesting moments. But overall, it's kind of like, oh. Like, I guess – and we don't know if they had freedom to reinvent this. So I don't want to – you know, if this was a job for hire where the script was
already – Yeah, they probably didn't have writing credit.
Probably not. Right? Yeah, I don't know. I didn't look it up at the time.
I will Google that
but,
quickly.
I would love to see – That's when you get to this point in a franchise, kind of give somebody creative control to like redo something, you know. But you know, some people who just love the series are probably going to be okay with it.
Yeah, that's a bummer because, like, especially when you have a break like this, you kind of hope that they'll just do something so left because there's no stakes, right? Because it's been whatever 10 years.
Yeah.
Since,
and they even talk about that where it's like, well, it's been 10 years since we've heard anything from the Jigsaw Killer. Why this can't be connected? And that's like that's how the cops get involved to begin with. So yeah, 10
they
years,
didn't write it.
You could have done something. Yeah, they did.
Okay. Then, you know, that could be part of it.
Okay.
So yeah, let us know your thoughts.
Yes.
If you like Jigsaw.
What about you, Becca?
So in addition to Jigsaw, I watched Anguish, 1987's Anguish.
I've been talking about this one for years.
Yeah,
this is the one Gaspar Noé introduced and just blew my mind.
Yeah. So this one, I did not think I had ever seen before. And it had been sitting on my to-watch shelf for a long time. And then as soon as it started, Dave and I had this flashback to us renting it in college and starting to watch it. And this is not blowing the film. In the opening scene, you see this mother and her son, and they have this pet bird. And the bird gets trapped behind a large piece of furniture, like a wardrobe. And they're trying to poke it out with this, like, it's like a coat hanger or something. And you're just waiting for the bird to get stabbed. And it's this crazy anxious scene because the bird is in there and it's really claustrophobic and the bird's like freaking out. Dave and I had watched this in college and we were both stoned.
Oh, yeah.
And we did not make it through that first scene before we were like, this is freaking me the fuck out. And we turned it off and we never went back to that movie.
It's a cinematic panic attack.
Okay,
oh,
but
my
this
God.
Is, just to clarify, we're talking about the 1987
Anguish
with Zelda
Anguish,
Rubinstein.
Yes.
Right?
Okay.
Oh,
you thought we were
about,
talking about Angst.
Yeah.
No,
no,
I'm
thought,
talking about 1987.
I know Anguish too. I like Anguish too.
Yeah, 1987's
Big
Anguish.
Because
there's also a newer Anguish from a couple years ago.
Yeah, there is. I've seen the box.
But this is what I thought you were talking about. The Zelda Rubinstein.
Yeah.
Yes.
So yeah, the opening scene, but it's still the same as you describe. It is a literal panic attack.
The one that has like mesmer kind of effects.
Yeah. So yeah, this is a Spanish film and it has a couple of different plot lines going at the same time. And then they kind of start to bleed together, but it's weird the way that they do. So the core plot is you're watching this mother played by Zelda Rubinstein who hypnotizes her son who works as an eye doctor. And she can talk telepathically through him, and she convinces him to start killing people and taking their eyes. And then you realize that this is a movie being watched by these two teen girls in a movie theater. And so you're watching them watch the movie, but then it goes back into the movie, and then you forget that these two teen girls. And then some stuff starts to happen to these two teen girls, but then the two plot lines really start to bleed together really cleverly, like trippy. The movie is full of visuals. Like, as you mentioned, it's got like the spiral hypnosis thing going and spirals factor in all over the place. Zelda Rubinstein has pet snails. So they do all these close-ups on the snail shells. There's birds. There's all of this eye stuff because the guy's cutting out people's eyes. This movie, like even that opening scene where it's like a panic attack on screen, it does not stop. Like the movie is just bonkers the whole way through.
This isn't on Blue yet, right?
I don't think so.
I feel like this movie's never been released on it, yeah.
I have the – I think it's from Blue Underground, did the DVD. Can you check on that, Rob?
Yeah, the DVD's been out for a while.
Yeah,
but
I've had the DVD on my shelf for a little while, and it was one that I didn't think I'd ever watch. But I'm pretty sure that Blue Underground did the DVD of it. And, yeah, it definitely could use a Blue.
Oh, yeah, that would be great.
It's got some great visuals in it and a really cool twist ending.
Yeah,
really
Blue Underground did it. And you may see a Blu-ray sooner than later.
Wow.
Just wait.
Very cool.
Okay. I only saw a couple. That was Anguish from 1987.
It was 1987's Anguish.
But also watch Angst.
Oh, yeah. Angst is great.
Because I guess it's a plug for that, too.
Well, they did just reissue it, I believe. So it's a timely announcement. I only saw two things that I wanted to talk about tonight. And the first one, I may have a bone to pick with you, Mr. Ryan Turek, because I have to go back and listen. But several episodes ago, you had mentioned revisiting Silent Hill Revelation, the second Silent Hill movie. I had never seen it, but after Ryan was like, you know, because I don't think he gave it a glowing review, but he said,
The guy who directed Evil Dead vs. Ash episodes and they have big triangles on their head?
They do have big triangles on their heads, but
I remember that.
But
one.
The first one,
I don't think the first one they had.
This was directed by Michael Bassett, who now has done episodes of Ash vs. Evil Dead.
This is the second Silent Hill one.
The first one is the director of Brotherhood of the Wolf.
Yeah,
and I kind of like it, but I don't think it's great.
It's very digital, visually, but it
suffers from story problems. It's kind of dragging.
All right, so the second one, which he thought was okay, I watched it in 3D, and even my love of 3D could not save this movie. It is so freaking bad. So bad. But it was pretty funny because Kit Harington, a.k.a. Jon Snow, is in it as a teenager at the high school. Weird. And he's just so awful. And then the other lead is Adelaine Clemens, who's like totally Michelle Williams. Like, we're like, is that Michelle Williams? It's like, no, it's totally like her clone. And Carrie Ann Moss has a role in it. Malcolm McDowell shows up for like 5 seconds. But, you know, it's just like, there's so many cool visuals and things about this. I just don't understand why anyone can't properly adapt a video game. Because literally it's like a strong opening, which, you know, I'm sure if it wasn't 3D, it would probably look like a CGI mess. And then, you know, just a long buildup of, you know, the girl goes to school and, you know, her and Sean Bean are like in hiding. And then Kit Harington starts hitting on her and like, oh, you're different. Like, you know, we should hang out or whatever. And then like, not even kidding, Exposition City, like nonstop reading like books of things, and then the convenience of like, oh, I'm actually from that world too, and it's like I can't even describe it to you because it's just like my brain almost turned off. But it's literally like reading, you know, like in between video games, like when you're in between a play screen, like all of a sudden you get to watch a segment. It's like those scenes in a movie. And I'm like, why can't you just – I don't need you to spell it out and literally tell me.
Do you think people are too faithful when they try to adapt a video game? Like they're
That's the funny thing is like I would love to ask people that love Silent Hill if this is – but here's the thing. That's the whole point of movie adaptations. It's visual.
Yeah.
Like I literally do not need a five-minute scene of you reading like just nonstop text. And it was funny because I was watching with our friend Josh Miller and he's like, man, he's like, you know – I respect actors that have to sell this.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. He's like, because, you know, like, as awful as it is, at least they're trying. Yeah. And you know, they're probably thinking like, oh, I've got to read 5 pages of dialogue explaining this book and this cult from Silent Hill and
just
how
to
it all ties in.
AJ Bowen about the end of your next.
I think that when you are making a video game into a movie, that you run into a lot of walls there, because the video game fans are going to want it to be true to the video game, and they're going to want the minutia of the video game, which is why you saw there was a trend where they were making video game movies that felt like first-person shooters. And it was awful.
Yeah.
And then, but in addition to kind of satisfying the video game fans, you still have to make it a functioning movie, but the two do not coincide very happily. So yeah, I think that you're always going to kind of run into problems, especially if it's like an IP when you've got two different entities involved. So you've got the studio company saying it has to be a good movie, but then you've got the video game company saying, well, it has to represent our video game well.
What other,
and
what other ones?
Game.
We've never really done that show. I mean, obviously Doom was... See, I think the first Resident Evil is actually pretty fun. Like, mm-hmm. they don't go too much into exposition land.
Yeah.
It's not great.
I still don't like it at all.
Yeah. But, can you think of any others?
I'm sure there's several.
Yeah, there's not, but none have really successfully like done that. And I don't understand it. Like,
Alone
literally,
in the Dark, right? That was a game, wasn't it?
Oh, the Uwe Boll one. Yeah. Oh God, yeah.
Oh,
but
God,
I've never seen
but
it.
That was just both the
like you haven't lived, Rob.
No, but there's so many cool like sequence, like the nurses. Like I knew that. Like mm-hmm. we got to a scene where it's like the still nurses, and they move when you make noise or whatever. And I'm like, see, that's awesome. Why is this such a lackluster scene in the middle of a lackluster?
I've got it. I know why they don't work, because William Malone didn't direct them.
Hey,
he makes them.
Right.
They were kind of ripping off a lot of
stuff.
He
should do Silent Hill.
And I do have to say, like, part of the charm of the video game of Silent Hill, which I played obsessively in college, like the original Silent Hill was like my freaking jam in college, is it's silent. Like, literally, you are walking around in the snowy landscape completely by yourself, and you know a monster's approaching because you start hearing static on this little radio you're carrying around. And that does not make for a very exciting movie. I can see why they had to tease out the plot. And the original Silent Hill video game had several different endings. Like, there were several different plot lines depending on what you did within the video game, which was really cutting edge at the time. But I was not happy with the way that they ended up kind of representing that in the movie. But I guess that's the way that they felt they did.
You know, it'd be cool if Larry Fessenden got to adapt his own.
Oh my God.
Their own video game that has him and Graham Resnick.
Yeah, oh my gosh, that was awesome.
I haven't played that one. I really want to
see it. Was it After
really
Dark?
Good.
Is that what
After
it's
Dark,
called?
Yeah, I'd like to see it.
There's a lot of video games that I've always heard, like, why isn't there a BioShock movie and things like that?
Because nobody knows that. Studios don't know how to pull it off at all.
It's difficult.
And again, when considering the nightmare imagery of it, it's like, I can't.
How do you fuck this up?
How?
It looks so awesome, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like,
especially
like,
Silent Hill. That world is pretty awesome.
Yeah.
It's pretty fascinating.
So I don't know. Silent Hill Revelation, I'm unfortunately not a fan of.
Hey, Suspiria 4K.
Hey.
Finally looked at it.
Oh, hey, hey.
And it's really good.
It is.
I will say this. I preferred watching it like this version on Blu-ray than I did seeing the new restoration in theaters. I can't explain what's up with that. Like, I felt in theaters, I still preferred seeing it in 35, and then seeing it was almost too clean on a big screen. But watching it on this Blu-ray, I'm like, this is the greatest thing ever. And it's just purely gorgeous. So just a further reminder that the good folks over at Diabolik still have some, I believe.
Oh.
Because last time I checked, they did. And if you haven't gotten this, totally worth your money. I saw a movie I freaking loved this weekend, and it was like bouncing off the walls.
Man.
Unfortunately, Turk did not like this movie.
I saw the exchange between you guys.
But the good news is, I really thought watching this, oh, I'm alone. I'm going to be the only person. Man, so many people online are saying the same thing. Like, this hit such a sweet spot with me. Okay, Mom and Dad by the filmmaker who made the Crank movies, Nicolas Cage and Selma Blair. It's basically a family idea where every parent on Earth, or at least in this town, in one key moment, suddenly has the overwhelming urge to murder their children. And you don't have the urge to murder anyone else's child. So, like, if little Timmy, the next-door neighbor, walks by and waves, you go, hey, Timmy, and then you try to kill your kid. And it has about 30 minutes before you kind of get into it. So it sets up this domestic life and the family structure. Selma Blair's really good. This is, like, peak. This is Cage hitting back to fine form. Like, it's super fun. He plays a character who, like, there's a moment in this movie where I was like, oh, my God, I'm identifying with this so much right now. Like, there's a moment where he's, like, talking about all the things he's had to settle for in his life.
I hope your wife's not listening right now.
No. And so does Selma Blair. They are both fantastic in this. I'll be interested to hear. I mean, like Ryan was kind of saying incoherent or something. It's just like, I think he's totally wrong. Look, I was comparing it to Killing of a Sacred Deer because I think they're both actually about the same topic of essentially the death of a child or something, or killing your own child. But I think that'd be a fun double feature because they're so freaking different. And one is, like, as he said, eating fine steak, and the other one is not eating fine steak. But man, I'm not kidding. This is going to shock you. It's easily this year, and as we've entered 18, the thing I enjoyed most so far.
Seriously?
Like, I'll go so far as to say I wouldn't be surprised if this is the kind of movie that, like, is my 10th spot at the end of the year. Like, where it's like, it's that little crazy
movie. We're only 24 days in now.
I know. I'm excited.
Wow, that is a bold statement.
But this film is funny. Like, to me, it's funny as shit. I would say the last, like, 20 minutes really loses a bit of a momentum, because it's pretty hard to keep the momentum going of this movie. And also, if you like movies like Night of the Hunter, where you like seeing adults chasing children, like, children in peril to grown adults trying to kill them, is there's something inherently funny to me. It's serious at times, but it's basically a dark comedy. But Nick Cage gets to go, like, off the rails, but in a way that makes total sense, because you're like, yeah, of course, he's homicidal right now. But yeah, I actually highly recommend this one to someone. And I have a secret, and people who listen here might know this about me, that I can't stand those Ghost Rider movies, couldn't watch them, but I have a secret weird love for the Crank movies, and I don't know what
it is. Oh God, I love Crank.
I watched them in the theaters, both of them, and when Crank 2 was on, I was sitting there at the most ridiculous moments going, why am I somehow drawn to this beauty and wonder?
I was the same way with Shoot 'Em Up, where
I never saw Shoot 'Em Up.
Oh, you'll love it if you love the Crank movies.
Shoot 'Em Up is great.
I've heard that
so much.
Yeah. I don't know what it is about Crank. And then watching Crank going, oh, imagine if Nick Cage had played this character. Like, you know, what is his name? Chev Chelios?
Yeah.
Drive Angry works the same way for me as well.
Yeah, it almost works for me, that one. And 3D, I think that is cool. But no, seriously, this movie is actually like a really fun movie. And you know, I apologize if it's not your thing and you're watching and are mad at me, but Ryan definitely disagreed for the record.
This is VOD now?
I saw it on Friday when it hit VOD.
It has reasonably good reviews online.
But I mean, I was looking at a lot of the critics who I tend to look at, like the ones who are into the same kind of movies, people who work at the, you know, the Draft House and stuff. And it seemed all of them were like, oh man, this is so much fun. So I didn't feel quite so stupid. For a second, I thought, oh, Ryan's busted. What's wrong with me? But no, I'm standing by it, man. I really enjoyed this movie. Good fun.
All right. Who else sides on Mom and Dad? Let us know online.
Let us know.
Becca?
So I'll do one more. So I watched Shock Corridor, 1963 Sam Fuller film. This one I watched through, it was a streaming service that we have, Canopy, I think it's called. And it had all of the Criterion films
on there.
Always
fun in those.
Always fun. This one was free.
Never heard of.
Yeah. This one I was
she's like a
free
junkie, always chasing the next
always,
high.
Always.
Like, I've done Hulu.
Streaming.
I need something else.
I'm done with Fandor. My relationship is over. I haven't done Fandor in a while.
Doesn't get me there anymore, man.
Nightflight is still like my jam, but this next one, Canopy, has like all the Criterion films, so I was watching that. At least I think that's the one it's on. But anyway, so I watched Shock Corridor from 1963. Sam Fuller wrote this in the 1940s for Fritz Lang, and it was supposed to be a film called Straitjacket, and they ended up not doing it.
And they were true stories. There was true. I remember like in the 50s, true stories about like a journalist trying to check himself into a mental hospital, but then getting mistaken as a patient, can't get out.
So that's the whole plot of it. Yeah. It is a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist decides that he wants to do he wants to win a Pulitzer Prize. He decides that he wants to do this huge story on mental hospitals. So he has his stripper girlfriend, who is not that much of a stripper. She's kind of burlesque, we'll say. Yeah. But she gets him committed. She claims to be his sister, says that he keeps trying to touch her, like incest-wise, and has him committed. And then as soon as he gets committed, he starts kind of having these weird dreams. Things start spiraling out of control. He starts having these flashes of the stripper talking to him and things like that. But at the same time, he finds out that there was actually a murder in the mental institution. And so he is trying to uncover the murder. But at the same time, his mental capacity is slipping. He's having to keep up this ruse that he is really insane. And he can't say, but now I'm actually insane. And everyone around him is nuts. But there's a lot of really good social awareness around there.
Other characters. They're really interesting.
Like, one of the characters has PTSD. It addresses racism. You can tell that it was kind of written in the 40s. Like, it's got a lot of noirish qualities with the stripper who kind of talks to him. by night and things like that. And it's definitely got, like, his name's Johnny and he feels like a detective and things like that. And then when it's done in the 60s, it was kind of perceived as an art film. But I'm telling you, if you made this film today, it would be perceived as a horror film just because it is so cerebral. He is a very untrustworthy narrator, so you don't know what's real and what's not a lot of the time. And yeah, there's some
and it's
really
black and white with these interesting dream scenes that are colorful. And it's a really great film. It's on Criterion. Yeah,
yeah, it's really good. So if you're kind of into more cerebral stuff, I highly recommend Shockwave.
I love that.
Really
Fuller.
Cool. Yeah, really good.
Do you have any more? Because I got one.
I do. Yeah, this is the last one for me. And it's mild setup, but I actually watched. I was inspired because I watched a movie called The Challenge from 1982 by John Frankenheimer, starring Scott Glenn, written by John Sayles. I bought this in a Kino Lorber sale. It's like a photo of Scott Glenn with like a sword on the front. I'm like, oh, this is kind of wild.
Is it like Swords
John
and Sandals?
No, I mean, it's quite – honestly, it was hilarious because I watched it with my roommate, Dave Foy, and we were watching it. And it's like Scott Glenn's like kind of like this boxer that learns – he gets in between a feud of two Japanese brothers and kind of learns the art of the swordplay. It gets kind of super gory at the end, which is the fun part of it. But we were laughing because we're like, so his character in Daredevil, the Netflix show, he's Stick.
Yeah.
I was like, I think we're watching the prequel to
the
Stick.
Origin story.
It's
yeah.
like his entire origin.
He must
story.
Actually be good at that, right? Because I feel like he's been in a couple other movies.
What? It felt like oh, we don't have Dave Carradine, let's get Scott Glenn.
Yeah,
and he just works. But anyway, that's not the main movie I want to talk about. We were in that frame of mind, we immediately felt like, you know what, we need to watch like Big Trouble in Little China again, because it's been a while and I'm kind of in that mood. And so we jumped right into John Carpenter's Big Trouble in Little China, blew my roommate's mind by showing him the music video of John Carpenter, Nick Castle, aka The Shape, and Tommy Lee Wallace. It is quite something. If you've never go to YouTube right now and look at the Big Trouble in Little China music video.
Nick Castle and Tommy Lee are in the video?
Well, they're the Coupe de Villes. Yeah, the three of them were a band together.
I haven't seen it for so long. That's right.
Oh, my God. I mean, the three of them together.
Yeah.
Anytime John gives us lip, I may have to pull that video up and be like, no, you're not that cool. Yeah, no offense.
That's funny.
But anyway, this led me – I've been trying to get into more graphic novels and books. I picked up the one that Becca talked about, The Black Hole.
Black Hole's amazing.
I haven't started yet, but I got it. And so the Big Trouble in Little China movie led me to the Boom Comics Big Trouble in Little China graphic novels. Because they've been out for a while now. And so I read the first two back to back, which I had lent to you at one point, Alec. And Carpenter sort of co-writes it with Eric Powell. And these are terrific. The first volume literally picks up the moment Big Trouble the movie ends.
Oh.
And so the demon thing that was the creature
the
on the
thing.
Back of the car, basically what happens right in the opening moments is that because Jack Burton has killed Lo Pan, now this demon is bound to him. So he actually is not trying to kill him. He's like his master now.
Huh.
And so Jack Burton calls him Pete. He just names,
how bizarre.
He names this you know, beast Pete. And then, you know, and then basically he has to head back to Chinatown because one of Lo Pan's disciples has kind of risen and is sending him to like no man's land to recapture and resurrect the three thunders and Lo Pan and all this stuff. It's just like the perfect, like whoever the writers got Jack Burton's voice so perfectly. And so immediately after watching the movie, when you read it, it's just so much fun.
That's cool.
And one of my favorite things about it is, they hint at all these other adventures. So, so at one point he's like, that reminds me of Mrs. Jack Burton number three.
Yeah.
And then it'll go into like a one page splash where he's like, yeah, she got involved with some dark cult or something like goths or whatever. And it shows she gets bit by vampires. So at one point, like Jack Burton fought vampires and didn't realize it. He wakes up in the morning with her and just like, pulls the curtains and she disintegrates behind him and he turns around. He's like, yep, I never know what happened to wife number three. She just left me. And so like the voice and the stories are really, really funny. Again, it just to spend time with that character again,
cool.
as if we were picking up from 1986. And that also led me to Big Trouble in Little China meets Escape from New York, which is also a comic series they did. This one's good, but it's not – you see photos of the two of them together, of Jack Burton and Snake Plissken, and you get all excited. You're like, oh, how's that going to work? It's fun, but compared to the Big Trouble series, like they don't get Jack Burton's voices right. And it's a little weird because basically they're doing like cross dimension. Basically, they're both versions of Snake Plissken from different directions. Right. That's why they look the same. And so it's a fun read, but not. And if you want to see those two characters together, I recommend it. But really, start with Volume 1 of Big Trouble in Little China. It's on Amazon for like $12, and it's so much fun.
Yeah, Big Trouble never fails to stay entertaining.
Yeah.
Man, what do you get when you take William Fraker, the cinematographer of Rosemary's Baby, Ennio Morricone, the composer of The Thing, the director of Deliverance? I mean, this could not go wrong. Unless it's Exorcist 2, The Heretic.
Whoa.
Oh, my God.
And here's the best part.
The Heretic or Heretic?
Heretic. It depends what part of the world you're from. I have purposely not seen this, thinking I saw this as a kid. Dude, first time viewing.
Are you serious?
And I did not. It was on TCM Underground this weekend. I recorded it, and I was like, I started watching it go, wait, maybe I haven't seen this. Because in my brain, I was like, of course I've seen it.
Did you notice the title card for Special Locus Photography?
Oh, my God. The locus. So
I want that job. I want to put that on my reel.
The amazing thing about this movie is that there is a line very early by the great Richard Burton, who's drunk off his ass the whole movie. He's the lead priest in this. He has a line in this movie that literally could just be the review of the movie. And it's like one of the best. He gets off the thing that they call the synchronizer, because it's all about this like piece of technology that they can wear and kind of psychically read each other's minds, even though you never really get to see much of what they see. Anyway, he takes it off and they go, how was it? And he just goes, it was horrible, utterly horrible. And fascinating. And that is a review for the movie. You really don't need more than that to get across it. I mean, I was like, the opening scene, I was like, oh, wow, this is pretty badass. Like, maybe this is a good, because I know there's people out there who love this movie. Yes. One of them has really good taste in movies and is often at the Egyptian. And I remember him, this is like his favorite movie. And I was like, oh, so it must be good. And I really did think I'd seen it before, because I was definitely familiar with moments. But no, watching this, there was like, nope, I would have remembered the locust. I would have remembered. So another way you could call this, because halfway through I was like, wait, there's a lot of buildup to like there's certain movies where you wait for the thing to happen in the title. So another title for this movie, Pazuzu Takes Manhattan, because it very much reminded me of Jason Takes Manhattan, where it's all, you're waiting for the thing that you've signed up for and you really don't get it. And even at the end, you don't really get it. But man, there are some things in this movie that I just can't, I can see why it will just be like such a cult movie, because it really is quite bad, and you're wondering, oh, what went wrong along the way? I know there's some essays out there on it, but
I have two things I can tell you about this movie that are very exceptional and exciting, but continue.
Well, the one that most threw me, okay, so very early on, so unbelievable that Max von Sydow came back, like that's bizarre, and he's in the, like flashbacks to the thing, but they have a part where they first put on the synchronizer, and Linda Blair in this is 17, it's 4 years after the original Exorcist, and one of the problems this movie has is because we're so used to this child, everything in this is like sexy, it's like she's trying to, the way she dresses and kind of talks to the priest, there's just something that, about it that feels a little off. To me, especially after being used to her as a child. The first time they put on this synchronizer, they start to do a overlay of Marin in what would just be a flashback in any normal movie. You would just use the real footage. Instead, they've got Marin now, so clearly it's a different makeup on him. But man, they cast a different actress as Linda Blair on a bed during the key climactic scene with really bad makeup effects on her. And I read later that Linda Blair actually said she would be in the movie but wouldn't do that. And I'm like, oh, my God. So instantly it is terrible what you're watching, because it's the uncanny. You're suddenly going, wait a minute, this isn't the movie that I've already seen a million times. They own the fucking rights. So why do they? I have no idea why they didn't just create an actual flashback.
Yeah.
And then you've got James Earl Jones dressed in like African garb in a thing as a kind of, I don't know, voodoo high priest of locusts. I have no idea what he's doing in this movie. It literally made my brain like melt. I'm trying to think what else. Yeah. I mean, well, the problem with it is it actually feels like a spoof at a certain point. So when you're watching a sequel to one of the most popular movies of all time and it feels like a spoof, there's a problem.
Yeah.
And with that many talented people, I actually think the stuff in Africa with the locusts and that is the kind of fun part and interesting. All the stuff in New York, you're like, what the hell is this movie? So anyway, it was quite the experience. Exorcist 2, The Heretic.
Heretic.
Heretic. Whatever you want.
The two things I want to tell you is, number one, Robin Flender, friend of the show, mm-hmm. director of Vital Hands. Next time we have him on, we need to ask him about The Exorcist 2, because he has a story that he told me about when he saw it opening night in New York City, and he said he still remembers the Coke getting thrown across, like the Coke stains on the screen because people reacted. But not only that, he said that's the only time he's ever seen that version of the movie, because they pulled it from theaters and recut it.
Yeah, cut it by quite a bit, right?
Like and so nobody's ever like he's seen the original first cut
vision. It's and that was coming off Zardoz.
Oh my god!
So he did Zardoz and this back to back, and then somehow made a masterpiece with Excalibur. So
was
it's like
able
what a
to
career.
Keep making.
Like yeah, no, he managed to make a comeback after that, which is amazing. But no, this movie's like is really quite one of the most baffling things I've ever watched. Where it's and it's there's enjoyable pleasures looking back at it. But my god, as a sequel to that movie, you're like I have no idea.
Well, that leads to point number two, which is Mike Cucinato, my co-creator on Icons of Fright, was obsessed with this movie. So obsessed that one day he just called me out of nowhere and he's like, Rob G, there's a good movie somewhere in The Exorcist 2, and I think I might have found it.
Oh,
I'm
my
like,
gosh.
What do you mean? He's like, I took out a half hour and I completely recut it.
Oh, cool.
And so he showed me a much shorter version that starts with the scene with Linda Blair with the things
That'd be a good start.
And I watched, I was like, this isn't bad.
Yeah. No, I could.
So
he needs to put it up online so everyone can judge.
Yes, there is an alternate. There's the Mike C cut of Exorcist 2 out there, which is shorter and slightly better.
Actually, you know what a movie reminds me of that's 100 times better is The Visitor. The Visitor is 100 times better, but there's so many things. The other problem is so many between Exorcist 1 and 2, so many of the ripoffs happened in that period that they almost missed the boat. Like, from Beyond the Door and things had already come out, and you're like, oh, it's like you're just, you know, and it's just the movie doesn't work at all. And, you know, I'll be curious to ask our guest his thoughts about that movie.
And maybe if
he saw that movie on opening night. Maybe he did. Maybe he didn't. We'll find out.
I have one more quick thing before we throw to our awesome guest. Have you guys watched, probably not, I'm guessing, the new show? Show on Sci-Fi Channel, Happy.
No. Oh, he said Sci-Fi Channel, so I said no.
What's it called?
Happy. I kind of stumbled on this over the Christmas break, and it has become one of my new favorite things. It is Christopher Maloney plays a cop who's now a hitman. And he kind of gets killed, left for dead, and his daughter gets abducted by a serial killer. And her fear brings to life her childhood imaginary friend, which is a bluish rainbow unicorn voiced by Patton Oswalt. And he follows Christopher Maloney around to try to save her from this serial killer. And it is amazing. Best opening I've seen in a TV show in a long time. The opening scene is literally Christopher Maloney puts a gun in his mouth, pulls the trigger. A geyser of blood shoots out of his head, but it turns into a disco ball, and then all of these other characters appear and start dancing with him while he's just bleeding out, but he's dancing too. It was madness, and so I'm really enjoying this. I'll say it's fringy horror because it does have the serial killer back plot, and it's mostly about Christopher Maloney being this absolutely hardened badass who is now taking advice from a purple unicorn, but it's really fun.
Yeah, it seems like it premiered in December 2017, and it's based on a graphic novel by Grant Morrison.
Yeah,
so
I have.
Oh, okay, now Grant Morrison, you get my start. Lead with that, Grant Morrison.
It's graphic novel, so by Grant Morrison, but yeah, it's really fun. So if you're looking for something that's pretty offbeat, it's not straight horror. It's definitely it's horror. It's comedy. It's a lot of crime in there as well. The serial killer is dressed up like Santa, and his moniker is Very Bad Santa.
Nice.
So that's pretty.
It's hard to know where
to
jump in with TV, I find, at the moment, because there's too many
shows.
There's
so much,
and you don't want to waste your time anymore. You know, there's too many options.
I only found this one because, and I never discussed it on the show because you guys will be like, that's not horror. But I really like the sci-fi show Magicians.
Not horror.
So I watched the sci-fi show Magicians, but after I finished it one night, it ran the promo and I was like, that looks interesting. Huh. But this one does have some horror notes to it. So
the Alienist looked interesting. I think the guys mentioned it last
week. They talked about it last week a lot.
That actually does look
interesting. It just aired this week, so I'm excited to check that one out.
Yeah, I'll check that one out too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Punch Drunk TV guys were raving about it. So let's hear from our sponsors one more time. In fact, our guest may be one of our sponsors.
And how excited are you? Like, I've never been this excited to talk to a guest about one particular movie in his catalog.
I know. Contain yourself,
I've become
please.
Obsessed by it, and I have friends who are obsessed with friends of ours like Jackson who want answers.
We're going to get answers.
For why this movie exists.
We're
going
to get
it's
a lot
so
of
good.
Answers. There's a lot to talk about. So
all right.
We'll be right back.
This week's show is brought to you by Severn Films and their new release Threads, available as of January 30th. The movie that shook the world, restored in HD for the first time ever. In September 1984, it was aired on the BBC and shocked tens of millions of UK viewers. 4 months later, it was broadcast in America and became the most watched basic cable program in history. After more than three decades, it remains one of the most acclaimed and shattering made-for-television movies of all time. Rhys Dinsdale, David Bearley, and Karen Meagher star in this graphic and haunting docudrama about the effects of a nuclear attack on the working-class city of Sheffield, England, as the fabric of society unravels. Directed by Mick Jackson from a screenplay by novelist-playwright Barry Hines, and nominated for 7 BAFTA Awards, the most terrifying and honest portrayal of nuclear war ever filmed has now been fully restored from a 2K scan for the first time ever. Available January 30th from Severn Films, check them out online at www.severn-films.com.
Today's episode is also brought to you by Shudder. Brought to you by AMC Network, Shudder is not only a premium streaming video service, but an experience unlike any other. Created for fans of all degrees of thrillers, suspense, and horror, Shudder is the home to the largest and fastest-growing human-curated selection of high-quality, spine-tingling, and provocative films, television series, and originals. There's always something new and unexpected for Shudder members to explore. Premiering exclusively on Shudder this week is the film Don't Grow Up. On an isolated island, a group of teenage delinquents living in a youth center wake up to find themselves alone with no one to watch over them. They realize the island has been deserted, or practically deserted. A few adults they encounter on their journey all seem to be infected by a mysterious epidemic, making them violent and dangerous. Best described as Skins meets 28 Days Later, Don't Grow Up is a tense story of oncoming adulthood reminiscent of John Carpenter. Shudder is available for $4.99 a month or $49.99 for an annual membership. But our listeners can get a free month by entering the promo code SHOCK at checkout. Go to Shudder.com today and find the best collection of thrillers, suspense, and horror available to stream anywhere. Promo code SHOCK for a free month.
Hey guys, Shockwaves is going to Texas Frightmare 2018. This year's convention is the 13th anniversary of this epic con. It's taking place May 4th, 5th, and 6th at the Dallas-Fort Worth Hyatt, and you don't want to miss it. Just announced, Paranormal Activity's Katie Featherstone will be joining. We have met her. She was at Jump Cut Cafe back in the day. Super cute and all, seemed like a really cool person. Other guests include Clive Barker and several of the Cenobites, Doug Bradley, Matt Lillard, Stephen Weber, Tobin Bell, Shawnee Smith from The Blob, Robin Perlman, Darren Lynn Bousman, Ethan Embry from Devil's Candy, and many more. Don't wait to get your passes. Go to TexasFrightmareWeekend.com and we will see you in Texas. Touch us on our face!
Do not touch my face.
That is going to be
our tagline. Do not touch my face.
You can come touch my face.
You can touch Elric's face.
Okay, and welcome back to the show. We are very excited. This could be one of the most exciting returns in yes. Shockwaves history because this guest was on way back for episode 8.
Back in the Rob G House.
Back when we were doing it in my apartment. Yeah. Very, very lo-fi style.
That was for their anniversary, I believe.
It was. It was for their 10-year anniversary. Yep. And then now we're all the way up to episode 81. And the main reason I'm excited is because so much stuff has happened with this company since they were last on. Not only that, when we did our Thanksgiving episode, we had done the things we're most thankful for. One of the things I picked was Severn Films.
Yeah.
Because they were introducing me to so many weird, crazy things that I never would have seen otherwise. So welcome back to the show, David Gregory.
Thank you very much for having me.
Oh, man.
And he, while we were off, when we were doing the ad, he was playing saxophone to my crotch. And it was super generous of the man.
It was really
sweaty.
Well,
I had to show you how
weird.
It felt.
and it really is incredible.
That is a Devil's Honey reference, which will be coming up
quite
a bit in the next hour or so.
I'm sure.
But before anything, you know, again, there's a lot of places we want to jump into. But more than anything, I think you come bearing exciting news, something that I may have got wind of early on and was hoping you would announce here on the show. So why don't we get that out of the way?
Okay. So April or May, we'll be bringing out The Changeling, which is quite a big acquisition for us. And it's a movie that's been out of circulation in any reasonable form for quite some time.
And a lot of people's favorite horror. Like, I remember people like Ty West would cite it as like the most influential film on him. A lot of people. It's a great, great horror film.
And how did that come to be with Severin? Because like you just said, it was out of circulation. I know it's one that's been requested by fans from all of the labels. And it was exciting that you got to be the label to get this one. So how did you stumble upon it?
Well, it was Philippe Mora, the director of The Howling 2.
Oh, yeah. So much. He's been on our old show. Yeah.
And he's such a Renaissance man.
He is. And he and I became friendly at a festival in Germany when I was playing Lost Soul. And I guess he was speaking to Peter Medak, the director of The Changeling. And Peter Medak's doing a documentary about a film we made with Peter Sellers early in the 70s, which was a disastrous production. And it's called The Ghost of Peter Sellers. And it's still not complete yet. But he was just starting on it. And Philippe suggested that he speak to me because I just made Lost Soul, which was kind of a similar disastrous production story. And so Peter called me and said, can we get together for, which in itself was amazing that Peter Medak was calling me to sort of ask about, making a documentary like this. And Peter's a delightful man, a great filmmaker. And anyway, at the end of the discussion about, you know, making a documentary about a disastrous film production, I asked him what was going on with the rights to The Changeling. And it turned out that he knew, who was in control of it now and put me in touch with them. And they were going through some kind of... It took a while between that time and us actually getting to sign in the contract. Let's just put it that way. But it all came together. We got the film elements. We did a new 4K scan. Ooh. Did a commentary with Peter and the producer Joel Michaels and a few other extras that were just putting the finishing touches on now. Awesome. And so then it'll be going into authoring pretty soon.
Wow, that is very, very, very exciting.
Yeah.
And we're really looking forward to it. And you yourself, I think I'm allowed to talk about this, but you yourself do your own scans these days, which is pretty amazing. And I a lot of people like hearing about this tech stuff, but how technical is it now that you have a machine yourself?
Yes.
Do you understand
I sort of understood the process before, but having that kind of control certainly helps in terms of, when we can prioritize getting scans done or even picking up smaller films that we may not have done because the cost of a scan would have been too much to get it to market. Mm-hmm. And so now, we've just picked up some strange American Mondo movies from Something Weird. So we're collaborating with Lisa from Something Weird. And so they may not have been the titles that we would have gone for if we had to pay for the scans and done all of that out of house. But now we can do it in-house and take our time and do them properly. We've done a few of the Something Weird titles.
I'm excited that you're doing some Mondo films. They don't get much love.
So it's Mondo Bizarro, Mondo Freudo, Echo, and The Forbidden. And they're all bought out. They were all distributed and produced, or at least the American version was produced in a couple of cases by Lee Frost and Bob Cressy, who are a couple of very interesting exploitation stalwarts from the 60s and 70s. So obviously there'll be extras talking about their careers as well, in addition to these new 4K scans of the movies themselves.
Nice.
Weren't you working on I remember seeing a photo from social media like a couple years ago where you and Jim were maybe shooting an Al Adamson documentary.
Yes.
What was that for?
So that is going to be, I've actually got three documentary features that are in post-production at the moment.
Wow.
And because last year became such a huge Severin production year, they kind of got shelved while we were getting all the discs to completion, but I'm doing one on the history of Dark Shadows for MPI, and then we've got the Al Adams, the life and death of Al Adams, which will be called something like Blood of Ghastly Horror, but I haven't quite figured out what the title's going to be yet. But that one we've must have interviewed 40 people now, including a lot of police and people from the crime itself.
But you couldn't get into the see the murder.
We couldn't get into it. It still might happen as a as a phone call.
Do you think
but
he would be open to it?
He's definitely open to it. He's adamant that he didn't do it. Although I've read everything about and it's a pretty thin case he has as far as
you just need to tell him, have you seen the E! True Hollywood Story? Because when Al Adamson has his own E! True, know that's something.
And so but no, we got all kinds
that's
of interesting footage from of Al, and we worked with started it in cahoots with Sam Sherman, so we've got all the films to put all the clips in and stuff like that.
But
we
went far and wide for people.
Yeah, we went far and wide with people he worked with over the years, and then right up to the grim crime at the end. And then the third one is Enter the Clones of Bruce, which Jim and I went to Hong Kong, Taiwan, and South Korea last year to interview all the various Bruce Lee clones. That was a big thing after Bruce Lee died.
My
they
gosh.
Filled the market with all these fake Bruce Lee
Bruce Lai.
Bruce Lai, Bruce Lai, Dragon
has
Lee.
All of these.
Yeah.
We've seen so many. There was like the fat Bruce Lee was one of them.
Enter the Fat Dragon.
Thank
that was Sammo Hung.
That was it.
But not Call Me Bruce, because that's like an American satire, really.
Right, exactly. They're mainly sort of unofficial sequels or biopics, but there was hundreds of them that came out in the years after Bruce's death, because this basically, they opened the door for this international market for all these martial arts movies coming out of Hong Kong, and then the guy died right as he got big, and so they basically had to fill the gap, and so all these clones came in, and at that time they were like, they figured all these people looked like Bruce Lee. They don't. Like, if you look at Bruce Lee and Dragon Lee, they don't look much like Bruce Lee at all.
But
they all
Ricky
start
like
the
that?
Same way.
Yeah.
Yeah, they all start with him bursting out of the grave. Like, there's
oh, really?
So
no,
many.
That's, okay, so that is Bruce Lee Fights Back from the Grave. What that is was our friend
good.
Terry Levine, who ran one of the 42nd Street Theaters and brought out Dr. Butcher MD and stuff like that. He just bought a martial arts film, which had nothing to do with Bruce Lee or Bruce Boyd. And he just filmed in a New Jersey cemetery a shot of like a Bruce Lee clone bursting out of a grave at the beginning, and called it Bruce Lee Fights Back from the Grave, and then just cut to the other movie. And that was it.
That was it. What's the other movie? Because I have seen that one so many times now.
Yeah. What's that?
Well, he does that the same thing in the Dr. MD, right? He filmed the New York.
Absolutely.
Wasn't that Roy Frumke's?
It was Roy Frumke's footage that they added to the head of Zombie Holocaust and made it Dr. Butcher MD.
You put out some crazy movies.
Yeah.
I haven't made it to Suffering Little Children yet, but that one looks pretty wild.
Yeah,
you have to see Suffering Little
Children. I think we should go backwards because right now we're on the cusp of Eaten Alive, correct?
Mm-hmm. Correct. Threads and Eaten Alive.
Threads.
Two very different movies.
Well, Threads is, so I mentioned that one because you're a sponsor on a couple episodes. And like Threads, I remember when, it wasn't BFI, it's Time Out, England, did the list of top 100 horror films. And, people like me and Brian Collins both looked at it. And I think we spoke right after. We're like, wait a minute, there's only one movie we hadn't seen. And he hadn't seen Come and See.
Come and See was
I loved
the other
Come
one.
And See, I loved.
Yeah.
I already loved that movie, but I wouldn't have called it a horror film, but whatever. But Threads was like way up there. And I was like, I hadn't even heard of it. But people in England, it had been always very much a part of the culture.
It traumatized an entire generation when that movie aired on the BBC. It was because it was made within a year of the day after, which was the American nuclear war film, which was already pretty traumatizing. But the director Mick Jackson, when we did the commentary, basically said that he almost gave up on making Threads because when he heard the day after was in production, that if they do it and they do it right, then there's no need for him to make this movie. But when he saw it, he said, at the end, society kind of starts to rebuild itself and people come together and figure out that there is a way forward even after a nuclear blast. And he was like, fuck no, that's not what would happen. Mm. Basically, everything goes the other way. People start to lose language, people will fight each other, and the nuclear winter wasn't covered in that. Basically, the whole planet will just become desolate, and there'll be nothing growing, and all this kind of stuff. So, Threads is a very grim film and very, very disturbing. And I've been trying to get the rights to it for about over 10 years at this point, was when I first tried to untangle the rights to this film, but it wasn't owned by the BBC. It's owned by the BBC everywhere else in the world, just not in North America. And I eventually found the person who did own it, and was able to get it. And then we got the elements from the BBC and then commentary with Mick Jackson and various other extras.
In situations like that, like where somebody's just been sitting on the rights and, you know, you have to track these people down. And I'm sure it's different for each project. But do people just not know that they have something that still has value, like that people want to see in the world, and they're just kind of sitting on a film? Or
In this case, I think the guy was just retired. Yeah. And so he had I think he probably owns other stuff as well, yeah. But I think it's mainly television material, right. So it probably wouldn't have that the kind of value that I would see, and you know, stuff that I'd want to put out.
Yeah, yeah.
So this was an anomaly, and so I was able to convince him that it needed to be done. And I think with all that's going on in the world at the moment, yeah. He was like, okay, maybe now is the time
good
to put
warning.
This movie out.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, I'd read, and this just might be like salacious Wikipedia info, that it had all of this licensing problem because it uses the song Johnny Be Good.
Yeah.
Was that still in there, or has that been removed?
Yeah, no, that was not correct. That was actually cleared. Yeah, I don't know where that came from or what. But
Wikipedia!
But Mick Jack, no, the director actually said something. It was about music as well. But we went back to the BBC and said, come on, you got a license, is this? And they said, no, it's got nothing to do with that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we co-produced this movie back in the day, back in 1984. And so it's, you know, we've never owned the US rights to this film.
Wow.
Which is good, because we never would have got it off the BBC. We tried to get an extra off the BBC because the director made a documentary beforehand about what would happen after a nuclear blast. And it had things like, this is what would happen to your flesh. And it just showed a leg of lamb and just with a blast furnace against it. So it was all bubbling, the flesh and stuff. So we totally wanted to put that on. But the BBC wanted something like three times what we paid for the feature, just to have it as an extra for a 25-minute documentary. So, but it's free on YouTube. So
Oh, my gosh.
Wow. Yeah, no, I'm really excited about seeing that one. And I know you've got a screening with Mick.
Yeah, we do. Mick Jackson, the director. Anyone who's in L.A. this Saturday, the 27th, we're showing it twice at the American Cinematheque as a Cinematic Void screening. So Mick Jackson will be presenting Threads this Saturday in Hollywood at 7 and 10:15, I think.
When I was a kid, my parents would let me watch any horror movie I wanted. Like, literally, when I was, like, super young, I was like, I want to see The Hills Have Eyes, and they were fine with it. But I was not allowed to watch...
You were lucky.
Yeah. I was not allowed to watch Nuclear Holocaust movies, though. They were very adamant about that, and I never understood why until I got much older. But I remember when The Day After came on television.
Yeah.
And I remember my parents were both like, oh, let's stay up and watch it. You're going to bed. Mm. And I was not allowed, and I remember peeking around the corner and just seeing like skeletal Gutenberg running around.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, they're bleak.
What's
so.
The Frank Perry made a post a nuclear war one? I don't know. Different show, I guess.
Yeah.
There's
a whole spate of them.
Yeah,
everyone
like
was freaking out at the time.
Testament.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's
Testament,
right.
Which was about a family at the edge of the nuclear zone. So they died slowly, mm-hmm. and they didn't all die. Like half the family died. But it was still left with like a wasteland apocalyptic thing.
Well, there was a famous one that the BBC produced in the 60s called The War Game, mm-hmm. which they got scared and didn't air, so it became kind of famous, and they played it in cinema clubs and stuff, so it's possible to see it, but it became famous because they didn't want to upset people. Apparently they thought too many people would just kill themselves knowing that the Cold War was going on.
Wow.
It's called Ladybug, that's the one that I was thinking.
Ladybug, that one
like more focused on a family, but again, it's really grim. The backdrop on everyone's mind is just so grim, and it's weird. I feel like when I see all the stuff with Trump and North Korea, part of my brain just can't believe that it could ever happen. So I'm in such denial that I don't take it seriously. But then your brain goes, oh, my God, if it was to happen, it would happen really quick.
Yeah.
Like it would be – we wouldn't even probably
well, unless
hear
about you were, it. Unless you were on the periphery, in which case you'd be facing the nuclear winter and everybody searching for food and rotten sheep, radioactive sheep flesh like you see in Threads.
And your teeth I'm fall out and you bleed from your anus.
Yes, exactly. And you have deformed babies and fun stuff like that.
Yeah.
Cheery movie. Seems like.
So
how do you market?
Yeah, if you want to see what we're in store, what we've got in store, if things go a bit wrong, then just watch Threads.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh my God.
Threads is the warning film. Well, and also, I mean, it's funny that you're then releasing that on the backs of Devil's Reign, where you're literally seeing people melt. So, you know, but that's a lot more fun.
Yeah.
How did that sell? Did it go away?
Devil's Reign was quite a hit for us.
Okay,
yeah,
good.
Yeah. Yeah, that and the Amicus box, which just came out.
One of the greatest movies ever, Asylum.
Yes.
Which
we only did 3,500 units, which we probably should have done more because they all sold out within a week, basically. They're all gone.
Wow.
What is interesting because, they're quite, I feel like Hammer's still classy horror, you know what I mean? Especially in modern day. And so when you're putting out stuff like Intervision type stuff, you know, the really grime stuff, but then now you're suddenly adding chinks to your armor that's going kind of legit here, yep. You know, with George C. Scott movies. It's a whole different ballgame.
Well, we also had, you know, things like Zulu Dawn and The Stuntman and stuff. So every now and then we do stuff Stuntman. That when I'm,
I forget
you know, at a family event or something, I can be like, yeah, these are the kind of films we do.
Yeah. You've had Peter O'Toole before.
Yeah, exactly. He's a Severin vet.
All right, so Lucio Fulci.
Oh, no, hold on. You're jumping all over the place. Okay. No, you can't skip over. So I had just seen Asylum for the first time doing my crazy 31 days of anthologies. I was very thankful that I got to see this version, an early test disc, which I think you knew about.
Yep, I did.
But it was all legit. And so tell me a little bit about this box set, how it came together, the titles in particular, and what these films mean for you, because this is a big deal. A lot of people are excited for this, and I am pleasantly surprised that it sold out.
Yes, me too. And basically, most of these movies I saw when I was quite young, so they're pretty important to me. But these were actually the ones that we were able to track down the rights and get the rights to. Most of them are owned by studios, so that makes them off limits for us. But we were able to get these three, and now The Screaming Starts, Asylum, and The Beast Must Die. And so we figured we'd box set them. We did new scans on now The Screaming Starts and Asylum. Beast Must Die, all the film elements are missing. So, even a movie that's that recent, and there has been film elements in existence within the last 20 years, a lot of labs have been closing over within the last 20 years. So even within that time, since it was last on disc, the film elements have gone missing. Yeah. So basically we had to use that. Luckily they did an HD transfer back then when the early days of HD transfers. So we did, it's still, you know, Blu-ray quality, but it's not of the quality of the other two. So that one's only available exclusively in the box, along with a fourth disc, which we tracked down all the trailers to all the Amicus movies except one. And so you've got all those trailers. You've got a commentary by Kim Newman and David Flint to every single one, which is a fun commentary because they have to jump from film to film every 2.5 minutes or however long the trailers
are. I love that.
I love these trailer compilations. You just put them on in the background.
No, they're great. And then and then we've just got hours of interviews with Milton Subotsky and Max Rosenberg, who are the two men behind Amicus.
Well, yeah, what's the history of Amicus? Because, I mean, I know as a kid, they all, like, even just now I've called them Hammer films. And what I know there were Amicus, but it's that part of your brain that Hammer's like the subgenre. But within that, there are some other companies that came, I guess, after Hammer's popularity, right? Springing up. What was their kind of backstory? They share a lot of the same talent.
They're actually both American, Max Rosenberg and Milton Subotsky. But Milton Subotsky was based in England. Yeah. He was quite the Anglophile, and he was the one who would source the stories and often write the scripts, or at least be consulting on the scripts.
Yeah.
I mean, they would get great writers like Robert Bloch involved in that thing. So he was pretty smart as far as, he was a real bookworm as far as, you know, horror short stories went and things like that. And I guess they started horror their first horror movie was called City of the Dead, aka Horror Hotel, but it wasn't Amicus. They weren't Amicus at that point. But then a few years later, in 1964, they did Dr. Terror's House of Horrors, which was their first anthology film, which kind of became their thing. I think they made 6 or 7 anthology horror movies, and then Milton Subotsky did another 2 or 3 after they were no longer Amicus. But they didn't have the same success that Hammer did in terms of like how prolific they were. But they also did a bunch of non-horror movies. They did The Birthday Party, the William Friedkin,
Harold Pinter play.
So they did the two Doctor Who movies with Peter Cushing in the 60s as well. They had a really pretty interesting filmography.
And
the anthologies is what they're known for the most.
Did it just run out of steam the same way like Hammer did, or did something put them out?
That was part of it, but there was a very acrimonious divorce between the two of them. They're both in the interviews. They're both not very nice about each other.
Okay.
And are these available individually now?
So now The Screaming Starts and Asylum are available individually. the Vault of Amicus and The Beast Must Die are only available in the box. And there are still copies of the box available on Amazon and stuff like that. It's just basically all 3,500 units have shipped from our distributor. So wow. Whatever's out there in the market now is all there is.
And you wouldn't do another issue of it?
That was kind of the thing to make it limited edition. We actually numbered every one so that it's something special.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
But you know, we probably could have done more than that. But you can't just go back and do that because then you're cheating the people who bought it.
Yeah.
In
yeah.
The first
yeah. Well, before Elric breaks out the saxophone, I know you're dying to. I just want to know a little bit about Jack the Ripper because I know this is a title you just put out around the same time as the box set, but completely unfamiliar. I don't know which Jack the Ripper movie this is or anything behind
it. It's not
it,
the so. Kinski one, is it?
No. So Jack the Ripper, this is a 1959 version of Jack the Ripper. British production, written by Jimmy Sangster, who wrote a lot of Hammer films, and directed by Baker and Berman, who were a directing team. They produced and directed a lot of movies in Britain in the 50s and 60s. I think they were involved somehow in the Saint TV show as well, but that's not my area of expertise. but this is another one where the film elements are now lost. So even though Deluxe had them in the early 2000s, because this is famous for having different versions, like they filmed the Continental version, which had nude scenes in it, and then they had the British version, which had one soundtrack, and then the American version, which had another soundtrack, plus like a color shot at the end of blood dripping through a floor.
Now, why would they change the soundtrack?
It was picked up by Levine. Oh, shit, what the? His name, Joseph E. Levine, who is a big a distributor who enjoyed his ballyhoo, so he wanted to make it more sensational. The soundtrack was much more sensationalist. Okay. It was a little less subtle. It's still a great soundtrack, but it's very different. And anyway, he picked up the movie and made it into kind of a big deal over here, and so we have all three versions on that. Special edition, which we only made available during our Black Friday sale. So it's got the American and the British on the Blu-ray, and then the Continental nude version in the on a DVD, because there was only standard definition elements for that.
Wow.
But we also got a commentary with Bob Baker, Jimmy Sangster, and the assistant director, whose name escapes me right now, but all three of them are no longer with us. But we recorded that commentary like 10 years ago when MPI were going to do the DVD, when the film elements were still in existence. And for some reason, they never did it.
Huh.
And so we never delivered that commentary. And then it's come around to this, and we still had the raw commentary. So we're able to include that.
So this was a Black Friday thing. Can I find this at your table at the next event?
Yes, we kept a few copies.
We'll see you in Texas.
Hold on to me, because I'll be buying one in Texas.
So they all sold out on Black Friday, but we kept a few behind so that we could sell them at conventions.
Okay, thank God.
Yeah. And as Valentine's Day is only a couple weeks away, you have one title that I think would make you should do a special sale on Valentine's Day. I think it's the ultimate Valentine movie. It is totally romantic. Beyond the Darkness. It would be the perfect, like, if you have a corpse in your bed and you make love to it, Beyond the Darkness is your thing.
Yeah.
That movie is so brutal.
It is a beautiful movie.
That is an ugly movie. Wow. All right, let's break out the sex fest.
I thought you were going to go to that one.
I did. That's going to be
the setup. I figured Devil's Honey was
too easy. Too easy.
You took a left turn, but okay, yes.
All right, this is for largely for Jackson Stewart and Patrick Bromley, two people who I know are similarly obsessed by this movie, and
a lot of our listeners, I'm telling you, week after week, we get another new Devil's Honey believer, if you will.
It was definitely my shock, because even these guys telling me, like, okay, it's batshit, you have to see it. I was not expecting it to be quite at that level of, like, just firing on all cylinders time.
And what do you mean specifically? You're going to have to go
and
into
it, well,
more
changes.
Well, it was the saxophone, but then, like, literally it goes past the saxophone.
Oh, no, I like horny motorcycle, but my favorite is flashback to movie theater where you get your friend to also, like, go down on you in the movie theater. Oh, my God, it's so great.
Yeah, like,
spoilers.
Never stopped. And then there was all of this emotional stuff that I was like, I don't even know how to deal with this. Like, he's obviously a horrible individual who's rapey and abusive and manipulative, but she misses him. It was just weird.
Yeah, there was definitely some control issues going on in that movie.
Wow.
And the sweater.
I feel like it's a movie of this moment. Yes. I feel like the moment we're in, you know, there was a lot of Devil's Honey t-shirts at the Women's March. Yeah. I noticed it was a very popular film with the Me Too movement.
David is rubbing his forehead right out of that statement.
No, what I want to say is what's cool about this movie is there is a lot of, I mean, I consider myself, I mean, Fulci's one of my favorite filmmakers. I did not know
this. This is a Lucio Fulci movie, in case we didn't mention that.
I never knew this existed.
I didn't know this one existed, and I think quite a few people hadn't even heard of the title, and some of us don't necessarily seek out his sexploitation films, mm-hmm. the earlier ones. But this movie, you know, so you watch it, it's a bonkers star. It's amazing, but I actually I found the reason I keep thinking about it is because I think the second half is also a good movie and really interesting in terms of like a revenge film that has a really interesting twist and kind of where it ends you're left like emotionally thinking a bit, which for Fulci is pretty complex, you know. So I think it's a really really interesting movie. So I guess I want to know first how you heard about it, how it got on your radar. I want to know everything.
Again, this was one that I'd had on my radar for a decade or so since we first started, but we couldn't find who owned the rights to it.
Had you seen it when it came out initially?
No, I had not. Okay. And it was I was told about it, and then I was sent. I think some Japanese DVD came out a while back, and it might have been a bootleg. I don't know, but all the nudity was fogged, and it was a 4x3 copy, and it was all that. But yeah, you could still tell that it was, let's say, a unique film. it's special, and I've always wanted to know who had it since then, and then it just showed up on the availables list of one of our licensors in Italy. It was just like, wait a second, you have that?
Did it have a reputation as this, like, holy shit? Like,
or just had nobody ever seen it?
No, the version that came out here, I think, was called Deadly Obsession anyway, and that I believe that was cut, so it didn't really make a splash at all. It was marketed as one of those
saxophone sex movies thrillers. One of those sex thrillers.
Exactly. But then and then amongst Fulci people it wasn't really kind of noticed that much because there's no real gore in it, you know. But then as time has gone on and people have started to admire Fulci's filmography as a whole beyond the zombie movies, you know, it started to gain sort of a reputation that way. And Stephen Thrower, who is on the disc, who wrote Beyond Terror, he holds it in very high regard, and he considers it the last really good Fulci movie. Yeah, yeah. You know, when Fulci still, the last time he had a proper budget, relatively.
Yeah.
You know, and sure enough, you know, when it became available and they actually had the negative and we were able to scan that in 2K, then it was like a had to be done.
And there's an interesting story in the making of where it was like Fulci wrote a script while he was sick. So he was sick for a year. He wrote a script, sold it to someone, and then got better, and then saw that movie and was like, ah, fuck, I still want to make that. And then just made that movie, right? What was that film?
You know, I forget the title of it, but that movie was made as well.
Yeah.
So it had a story by Lucio Fulci.
So there's another version of this running around. Yeah.
But maybe not with saxophone.
No, I don't think it genitalia. Has the saxophone. I don't think it has Brett Halsey.
Yeah, yeah.
And all that makes it such a wonderful, unique film.
Wow.
Oh, it's special. Like, and so when you finally did get to see the proper version, did you just instantly know, oh yeah, this is it.
Oh,
this is going to be the thing that makes Severin on the map.
Yes.
Like, this is going to be on your gravestone.
This is the one. Move over the changeling.
Yeah.
The devil's honey is coming.
I don't know. I still think Burial Ground is definitely up there.
Burial Ground is definitely one of my favorites.
That was one that I had not seen until you guys re-released it, and I thought I had seen it. Mm-hmm. And it was one of those moments where I was like, man, I haven't seen Burial Ground in a while. And then I was like, I've never seen Burial Ground before. And then the ending, nothing, because no one had spoken to me about it. I thought I'd seen it, so I'd never read anything about it. Nothing prepared me for the ending.
Yeah,
Burial Ground.
Well, it's just amazing thing. When you think about, you know, how they would just come up with ideas in these lower budget Italian exploitation horror movies, because they were just like, let's include, you know, a man child and a nipple biting.
Yeah.
You know, it's like we've got to push this a bit further than the last one went, and so that's end up with Burial Ground.
Yeah. Well, I loved seeing the little snippet of Peter Bark at some screening, I guess.
Yes.
But it was hilarious because I went down the Peter Bark rabbit hole online because I can't remember when the screening's from the Q&A, but it's several years ago.
Yeah.
And he's almost like not answering anything because he's I'm writing a biography.
Yeah.
And so
here's the thing
I couldn't find the bio. So what happened?
Was that so he was missing for years. It was among horror fans. It was a big deal to find what became of Peter Bark. And then I guess somebody found him and he showed up at a convention or a festival in Italy. And it was like, yeah, Peter Buck, but he didn't really have much to say. There was a couple of interviews. There was that Q&A, and there was some interview on Rai TV in Italy, and he also didn't have much to say in that. But it's fucking Peter Buck. So we were like, when we went back to the location, the house where it was shot, Villa Parisi, where they also shot Blood for Dracula and Nightmare Castle and tons of other Italian horror movies. And the place still looks exactly as it did then, you know, including, you know, the plant pot that the zombie kind of crawls out
Can
of.
Can you tour it, like, as a guest?
No, we had to actually rent it to go there and shoot the featurette, right? And we actually brought Stefania Cassini, who was in Blood for Dracula, there as well, and we shot with her.
From Suspiria, too,
Suspiria,
yeah, just
too.
We interviewed her at Texas Frame. She's one on stage. Yeah.
Right. And she so she remembered everything from Blood for Dracula. Well, we wanted to get Peter Buck to come there because we couldn't find anyone else who was in Burial Ground to talk about Burial Ground. So Peter Buck, we approached him, and he basically said, I've now got a huge fan base in America. You know, you need to make it worth my while. So I think we offered him a token fee, and he came back and was just like, no, you need to speak to my agent, which was clearly him. But he was basically like, the agent came back and said, you know, he needs 10,000 euros, which is, what, $12,000 or something like that.
To do one interview on a Blu-ray bonus feature.
Yeah. So and you started a Kickstarter.
Yeah. So we were basically like, I don't know that we're going to get Peter Buck in the extras on Burial Ground. But we were able to license that footage of the Q&A.
Wow. So he's out there.
He's fucking out there, yeah. And this, he really is.
And is it true, like, people, I've heard this rumor, but is it true that he lives with the little boy who played Bob? Because I've heard the two of them live in a house together. Bob! Bob! Yeah. And they just sit around looking at each other strangely.
That guy, I think he lives in the U.S. I think
oh, my God, I want to
like
meet him.
Yeah. Bob should be a guest on the show.
Yeah. Oh, my God, that would be... Stephen Scarlatta would have to come on to co-host he'd be so excited. I mean, there's so much interest. Tell us a little bit about the ones like Suffer the Little Children and another one you just handed...
Beyond the Seventh Door.
Because I know nothing about either of them.
Okay, so Suffer Origins. Little Children was one that was quite controversial in England when it came out because it was made by a teenage drama group. And their teacher and their teacher's husband was basically the director. Huh. And then England being England in the 80s, basically, they were like, oh my God, it's child abuse, unbelievable. You can't believe you're getting them in a horror film and all this kind of thing. And they didn't help because they, on the box, they pretended that it was a true story, that something that really happened. None of them have ever been heard from again and all this kind of thing. And then it ended up making the national newspapers about how it was, you know, this is just wrong to have children involved in a film like this.
Is there a documentary on the disc?
There is. We got an interview with the director talking about it. And also John Martin, who wrote The Seduction of the Gullible. And they basically talk about, you know, how this whole thing came about. But the only version that ever came out in England after that was cut quite a bit. So we were able to get the uncut version. And sure enough, the climax of this movie is pretty insane, brutal, and
Is it SOV?
Delivers.
It's
shot on video. Yeah, so it was one of the early shot on video films.
Interesting.
And
okay, yeah.
Well, you'll love it, Elric.
Yeah, I'm definitely
going to
watch
it.
It's been sitting on my shelf since probably last convention.
Yeah.
That and Darkwater, which I have to, everyone else says I'm going to love that one too.
Awesome.
So.
Yeah.
And then what about Beyond the Seventh Door?
So Beyond the Seventh Door is a Canadian film that is kind of like, I suppose, it's kind of like The Cube. It's one of these kind of puzzle films where the two leads get themselves caught in
a Canadian
situation,
thing?
I guess.
It's a Canadian go to.
But it has this. It has this lead actor, Lazar, his name is, who is a very strange-looking man. I mean, and gives a very non-performance in the film. So that's like just adds a surreal edge to the film. And then Josh Johnson, who was the one who kind of discovered the film, he went up to Canada and did a awesome featurette with the two of them, what they're doing now. One of them is running a cinema and, you know, and then how... I think God had something to do with it as well, but I'm not quite sure.
God's in there somewhere.
God's in there somewhere, yes.
Oh, man. There was another... God, there was one of your titles I really wanted to ask about. But for now, I'm going to actually delve into Severin expanding by acquiring some newer films. I'd watched one that you put out called Bag Boy Lover Boy.
Yes.
Very proud of that. Holy shit.
Yeah.
Elric, you need to see
this
movie.
I remember you talking about it.
I remember the DVD cover or the Blu-ray cover for this. But
it felt
I don't believe I watched it.
Oh my God, you guys got to watch it. It's fairly short too. It's like 80 minutes or whatever. Yeah. But it's and it was about, I think it's 2014 or so. To me, it feels like the real modern Maniac remake.
It is. No, it is. Like, and it has that genuine feeling of Maniac and Basket Case.
It
and,
is. Yes.
Driller Killer. So it feels like one of those New York movies, but in current New York. But it has the sleaze factor because he's a hot dog salesman in the middle of the night, so it's all very sweaty and sleazy in New York.
And who is this? I mean, because I know nothing. It's almost like this was this magical thing you dropped on us. Yeah. And like the guy who plays Albert is very odd. Yeah. Is that what he's
say
really
say this name
like?
One more time. Bag Boy Lover?
Bag Boy Lover Boy. And again, I wanted to talk a little bit more about this because this isn't the only one. Obviously, you did the documentary, The Other World,
Feed the Light.
I just like that in the last year or so, Severin is delving into these newer titles that definitely fit within your filmography.
Right. Bag Boy in particular. Bag Boy was another one where at the same festival in Germany that Philippe Maurer and I were talking, I met the director Andres Torres of Bag Boy Lover Boy, and he was in Fantasia. He took it around to a bunch of festivals. He won a couple of awards at New York Horror Film Festival. I think he won Best Picture and stuff like that. But he didn't really know what to do with the film. And so we just said, well, if you haven't got, you know, distribution, I'd love to put it out because it really? Really, really fits the brand. And I think the film is very, very unique. And even though, I had to make it clear, it's not like our forte doing new movies, it definitely fits the Severin name.
Well,
it's a really perverse film.
I feel like most distributors would be scared to touch it.
Well, that's the other thing, was that we'd probably be the only ones who would get behind a movie like this and truly believe in it. Yeah.
But Feed the Light was like a Swedish art film, right?
Correct, yeah. So okay. It was a Lovecraft film, yeah.
Oh,
exactly. Really? And again, somebody I met on at a festival, Henrik Moller, had done this black and white Lovecraft film based on Color Out of Space.
Oh.
And
I got to see that.
It's really cool.
It's a very cool, you know, you can tell he did it with little resources, but it's a very cool little movie.
It's very atmospheric.
Yeah. Yeah.
Speaking of the more art house films, Kathy's Curse.
Yes.
By the way, one of the greatest moments in Shockwave's
history.
In podcasting history,
out of the ether, knowing
out of nowhere, pick that title and you're like, actually, we are putting that one out.
That probably was one of the most exciting
moments.
And
Brian Collins stopped breathing momentarily.
But how have people reacted to that? Because, I mean, obviously that was a film that went from like really zero exposure except for a few weirdos. And I remember seeing it at the Cinefamily.
One weirdo.
Did you just call Collins a weirdo?
He's
a weirdo.
Well, we know.
And Phil Blank screened it once and it was brilliant. But it's one of those ones where when I would recommend it to someone, like I get super excited and tell them about it and then they'll watch it. And it is, man, talk about a hit or miss. It's either that person coming back and going, this is the greatest thing ever, or they look at you like you're fucking insane.
Yeah, that's like my death spa or my murder rock where I'm like, you are either going to think this is the greatest film ever made or you're going to come back and tell me I suck.
There's no Kathy Kirst gray area. But how did that go? Because I think we haven't spoken since you actually
played. No, it's, well, it went very well, actually. Yeah. I mean, I think the fact that we were able to get the full uncut version out there for a start made it look like the filmmaker wasn't completely incompetent. Yeah. You know, that's certainly the cuts that were made to the US release version.
I like the other
version. But that's why we put the other version on as well, because people love the other version.
Because you don't want exposition.
Well, and he was, he doesn't think it's any kind of masterpiece either, but he... but he was very surprised that we were even interested in it, and actually really quite pleased. He couldn't believe that it was getting all this attention, and he was being interviewed. And he's gone on to have a perfectly good career in French television and stuff like that. So he's fine. And now he's adopted some kid from Africa. So he's like, now I've retired. Now I want to give something back. And he's like, now I'm going to become a father and all this kind of. So he came down to Cannes and met with me and Carl, and he was just kind of laughing the whole time. He was like, this film of all the things that I've done in my life. You know, why this one?
It's genre.
I'm like, well, you've seen the reviews now, you know. And even in the reviews, though, some people were like, I don't understand what Collins is on about. It's just ridiculous.
I love that they always call him out.
Yeah. He's kind of the patron saint of Kathy's Curse.
We all have our movie that we'll champion to our death. But no, I knew you had won when there's more of a, like a high, you know, highbrow art cinema cinema site called Pinland Empire, where they'll do side-by-side comparisons of the movie. And of course, just even a couple weeks ago, popped up where they're comparing the water scene with Don't Look Now. And I'm like, Kathy's Curse being elevated to Don't Look Now status. I'm like, that is a win. Because no one would have known about this movie had it not. I mean, that's the great thing about physical media and what you guys do. Yeah. Like, with some of these movies would just be like rumors.
Yes.
Like Devil's Honey would, I mean, a lot of us wouldn't have even heard of Devil's Honey. But now it actually gets to be something you can share and blow someone's mind with.
Yeah, I it's that gem that. You get to talk about.
Oh, yeah.
And I love that you, I mean, you guys found and interviewed Kathy, which when Collins was on the show a couple of weeks ago, was saying, he's like, oh, thank God, because like on her Facebook, she's like, what's wrong with you people? Yes. Leave me alone.
She was kind of standoffish to start with. She's like,
and her mom,
serious?
Right? Her mom's and in her it too. Mom, super bizarre.
Yeah, well, her mom was on the set because, you know, her being however old she was, she had to be there the whole time. So they made her the costume designer. She had to pick out Kathy's clothes on before she got
to the set. She wasn't wearing a lot of clothes in the snow. It's like she almost killed her.
Yeah, so... But it was really sweet because they're just, you know, they've got nothing to do with movies or anything like that. And she's got like the little scrapbook and she's
felt very the kitchen Canadian. Table.
That's nice of my mom to have saved these cuttings for me, you know.
So what is the grail? Like, is there a movie that you guys have always been looking for that you would love to get, but for some reason or another you guys can't?
It's definitely Blood for Dracula and Flesh for Frankenstein. And I have a feeling
that's your Warhol films? Because of the Warhol Foundation?
No, because of Paul Morrissey, the director.
Yeah.
He owns them and he will not license them, and I'm sure if it ever comes to a point where they're licensable again, we probably won't get them because they're pretty big movies, but that's why I shot the thing with Stefania Cassini. Even if it never sees the light of day, I actually got that interview. I interviewed Joe D'Alessandro, Udo Kier, and you know, I've got all the stuff for the extras. We can't get the movies. Paul Morrissey himself just won't license them.
See, I spent a day with him. He came to our film school, right? And I was so excited. I'm down in Savannah. I hear Paul Morrissey. No one knows who he is. And I am going crazy because I'm like, oh my God, you guys got to watch Blood for Dracula. I watch these films. I show it to them. I'm so excited because these movies to me are so out there and like liberal. And I meet Paul Morrissey. And we literally spent an entire day with him doing things. And he was one of the most conservative people I've ever met. Yeah. He basically, everything out of his mouth, especially towards Warhol, was brutal.
Yeah.
Really?
And he seemed like a very, I mean, once he would talk about movies themselves, that was fine. But man, most of the day, and I was, of all the people I've ever met in my life, that was the most shocked of how different someone is versus how their movies were. Mm. I couldn't believe it was the same guy.
Which is funny because he spent so much time trying to prove that he was the one who made these movies.
That's all he kept saying.
Had nothing to do with Warhol. Yeah, they're like, particularly Flesh, Trash, and Heat, they're not the work of that guy you're talking about.
Yeah.
Now, how did he, I've seen both of them and the insanity that they are, but how did he get involved in the process to begin with? Like, was he just a straight-up director for hire?
No, they were what the Warhol in the factory, productions, essentially. They were actually Carlo Ponti productions, but Warhol did visit the set, so there was some connection with Warhol on like how they were going to market them and that kind of thing. But at that point, Morrissey was Warhol's director. He had directed Flesh, Trash, Heat, maybe even Women in Revolt at that point. But anyway,
he probably had filmed the screen tests, all those things that they were doing in the factory.
But most of the it's when from what I understand, from Morrissey took over when there started to be actual direction.
How does that guy work with Holly Woodlawn? How does the guy I met?
I worked with Holly Woodlawn.
Oh, really?
Holly was in my student film. Awesome. Yeah.
Oh, awesome.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Oh my
what a great presence in a movie. Yeah. Trash is great. I think Trash is one of the best.
I brought Holly out to Boston to play kind of the character character that she played in Trash.
So where does he live now, though, Morrissey?
He's in New York. Yeah.
Okay. Interesting. I wonder if somebody. So do you think it's just like he doesn't approve of them anymore? His own work.
It's not even that. And I've tried many, many times. Yeah. And I was actually speaking to a guy today who used to represent the films, and he's like, Paul's just not interested. He's very well off, and
so he doesn't need to.
He's like, I can't be bothered to go back and get
Alan
the
Klein situation.
Exactly.
It's like Alan Klein all over again.
Yeah, but he had a reason to hold on to.
What was his reason, though? Really?
Basically, Hodorowsky, he was supposed to do The Story of O with Alan Klein, and then they had a meeting with all the people to do it. And instead of showing up to the meeting, Hodorowsky got on a plane and was like, "I will never be the person to do The Story of O." But he only admitted that after they'd made up. Jodorowsky basically made out that it was Alan Klein being difficult, but it wasn't Jodorowsky.
And he turned down George Harrison for Holy Mountain, which I did not know until this weekend.
Yeah, because he wouldn't wipe his ass.
What?
Because he wouldn't wipe his ass in that beginning bit where U.S. shit.
Well, and he wanted to show it's junk.
Yeah.
Because the character's meant to be nude.
Yeah.
And George Harrison goes, I don't know if I want to be nude because I'm worried. And Jodorowsky said, but the screen is so big, you will look like a god.
Wait, is that the Jodorowsky role in the movie?
No,
it was at the beginning when he's explaining about your I can't even remember what it is. You can turn your shit into
the guru character,
the guy who's up in
that. Yeah, that's just
that character makes more sense. Okay,
What other Fulci movies can we get? Any other secret Fulci movies I need to know?
I don't have any secret Fulci movies in the pipeline. We've got plenty more Joe D'Amato, plenty more Jess Franco coming, and. Blood on Satan's Claw. That's
that's a big Becca title.
I love that movie so much, and it was one that Sam Zimmerman had recommended to me back when we were at Fango, like 10 years ago. He was, because I love Wicker Man so much. He was like, "Oh, you got to see Blood on Satan's Claw," and so I got the UK DVD of it at the time. Made Elric watch it.
Yeah, we played it at Jump Cut.
Yeah,
I hadn't seen it before.
Jump Cut. And
mixed results, but I thought it was
It was
really
one of these
mixed results.
Yeah,
we were surprised. A lot of people were really bored by it.
Yeah, some people were really bored, including Rob. I think Rob was.
Yeah, I wasn't a fan. Sorry.
And they were also
Linda Hayden didn't catch your attention.
I know.
For fuck's sake.
I'm like freaking demonic demons with.
I'll watch your restored version, damn it.
And I love the framing device, which I think was like you could feel that it was like an add-on where like. The guy shows up at the beginning and he's like, there's clearly Satan in this village. I'll be back with help. Mm-hmm. And then at the end, he shows up with the largest sword in the history of swords and just kind of swings it around a bit. And then that's the end of the movie.
That's it.
And it's wonderful.
The Nick Cage remake will be good.
Yeah, there you go.
I feel like he does all British folk horror. It's just like, why not?
Now, did you ever see Skinner? The movie with Ted Raimi.
Yeah, I love it. You guys are doing
that
one, right?
As well, yeah.
Skinner, remember when Ted was on, we brought it up, the movie he did with Tracy Lords. I spent a considerable amount of time asking him about it. And of course, Severin's going to put it out. Yeah. I love it. Another really pleasant surprise, last year we were all at Texas Frightmare together because you're usually there with Severin.
Yes.
And almost immediately, it was the first time you'd put on sale Blackenstein, the Black Frankenstein.
Yes.
And it sold out pretty quickly.
Yes.
I finally got it after Texas Frightmare. But I'll tell you, the movie itself was fascinating to watch. No, legitimately, because I think I got a DVD of it years ago and I wasn't crazy about it on DVD. And yet the type of restoration work you guys do, there was actually a lot of cool stuff to love in the movie. Yeah. Like I really loved...
Well, for starting with the fact that we had the actual final version of the movie, which is the shorter version of the movie.
Yes.
The version that's always been out before is the longer version, which seems like it was some sort of rough cut that somebody finished without consulting the filmmakers. I don't know how they both came to be, but certainly the shorter version seems to be the finished release version of the film.
Yes, and that was a pleasant surprise. But more than anything, I loved the features on here because a lot of people don't know kind of the true crime behind was it the writer?
It was the writer and producer of the film.
Yeah. Who still his murder is unsolved.
Still unsolved, but it looked like a mob hit. Basically, he was a lawyer for lots of mob clients, and so nobody knows exactly what the circumstances were. There's also rumors that he borrowed a lot of money, maybe to make the films. He was also quite a fan of gambling and that kind of wild living as well. So he might have just got himself into too much debt that he couldn't have paid back. There's lots of speculation. But I went to visit his sister in Phoenix, and she just had all this stuff that he had at his house, and it was just tons of scripts of like Black the Ripper and
wasn't there like White Werewolf versus Black
White Werewolf versus Black Frankenstein and all this kind of thing. It was just like tons and tons of he was a real kind of Forry Ackerman monster kid. He was part of the Dracula Society and stuff like that. He loved monsters, this guy did. So he had all these scripts that were based, that were kind of like, I guess, doing, you know, a big franchise of Black Frankenstein.
It's a shared universe.
Or things like that. Yeah, exactly.
The Hughes brothers should have made Black the Ripper. Exactly. That would have been.
So I have the script for Black the Ripper because there's always been rumors that it was a film that was shot and maybe even completed. But there's no evidence that that was the case.
Bob Murawski's editing it now.
Well, that would be great. Get to it, Bob.
20 years later,
Bob's putting it together.
That's what Bob does.
So that... For me too, though, that was kind of a big part of why I wanted to pursue Blackenstein. I'd seen it when I was a kid as well, you know, which are often the impetus for putting these movies out. And I liked it then, and I still kind of like it, think it's quite charming now. But yeah, when I started reading that backstory, I was like, okay, I've got to investigate this a bit more.
Yeah, but I think that's part of the charm of, in particular, Severin's releases, which you know, everybody does a good job when it comes to special features. But something like Blackenstein on its own might not be like the greatest value. But I like having this restored film and then this amazing interview with his sister, which is like a great.
Yeah.
Like you tend to always kind of balance a great story behind the movie with
Well, what was funny about that as well is that Jim and I were in Phoenix to do that, and then we went to Tucson the next day to do a couple of interviews for the Al Adamson documentary. And it turned out that these guys also knew Frank Seletri. So we got to ask them about Frank Seletri as well. And they talked to – so that ended up on the disc. It's just kind of outtakes from those interviews.
Is there a large concentration of like exploitation filmmakers in Arizona?
In Arizona, yeah. They've retired there.
The system has nothing to do with exploitation filmmaking. And then Bob Dix, who starred in The Day the Earth Stood Still, I think, or maybe Forbidden Planet. It was Forbidden Planet. Yeah. He now just lives in a trailer park in just outside of Tucson. So he's like, and he's proper old cowboy type bloke. So we went and interviewed him there. And then the other guy, I don't know where he was in Arizona, but he was somewhere else in the Tucson sort of area.
It's wild where all these people end up. All these stories around the movies. Yeah. Any chance that Mondo, a lot of people are having luck with vinyl? Devil's Honey vinyl.
It wouldn't.
Some crazy saxophone.
It's
in
like
there.
A 4-minute vinyl with just one track.
It wouldn't be us that did it. I mean, we are putting some soundtracks in, but they're on CD. We're doing Emmanuel and the Last Cannibals with Emmanuel and the Last Cannibals. Eaten Alive is with the Eaten Alive. Ooh. And so, but yeah, that's a limited run type of thing. We looked into doing vinyl with Accent Kidnap Coed, but it was just a whole door we didn't want to open.
Yeah, and there once we got it. We should remind people to watch those. Those were really interesting.
Well, you should ask your question. You do every time we have a DVD distributor on, which is basically, what is a title that you wish sold more? Because we're going to sell it
now. We're going to push it right now, and
what's
you will
the title?
Sell.
But it has to be one
copies.
In the last since last we saw you. So, what of the ones has underperformed
other
from what you thought?
than Bag Boy Lover Boy, which I do strongly recommend as
and
it
Devil's
is totally
Honey,
a modern maniac.
Well,
it's funny you say
one?
That because it did because it did underperform Bag Boy Lover Boy did, and it's very it's a very different world to try and sell a new movie. To try
isn't
and sell
it weird?
One, sorry.
Yeah,
and the majority of people who buy our stuff, they're into films of a certain era, and so to even to tell people that it is very much one of those films, and it's something we completely endorse. It's not necessarily going to make
a blind buy. Let's pretend that movie is a lost gem from the '80s, and now everyone will buy it.
Did you have to seek out a whole bunch of different distribution channels with that one to suddenly like? I mean, did you push it in Best Buy and things like that?
You know, they're not good. Best Buy's not going to take. This film and that's the thing. So it had to be in the same distribution channels, although we got it onto various digital platforms, being a new movie. But it'd be, you know, even then it's like it's something that most people, I wouldn't say everyone because it's also a love it or hate it movie, but certainly it got a lot of positive press and a lot of people talking about it. Anyone who actually saw it will talk about it even if they didn't like it because it's, you know.
So, guys, we want to sell some copies of Bag Boy.
Is there any of the older ones that you kind of like, you know, you get like a Devil's Reign where.
What did I say last time? Do you remember?
I don't remember.
Well, I would. So I just mentioned Axe and Kidnap Coed. That is definitely one that I wish had sold more because in addition to the fact that the movies are great and deserve to be seen, that's two movies on one Blu-ray, and then you get the third composite movie, which was made later, so the director could kind of
Came on to talk about that. At the time, I remember when we watched Axe, I think the first thing I remember saying, there's a scene where they go into like a liquor store or whatever, and there's an apple, and all I remember walking out going, that feels like a scene that Tarantino watched and thought, this is the greatest scene I've ever seen. I felt like Reservoir Dogs is like built from that scene, but I don't know if he would have ever seen it.
I don't know, maybe. I mean, it had quite a lot of distribution, but this has all gone into on the disc as well about how the movie was kind of taken by the distributor from the filmmaker. And so we did do a pretty pretty intense documentary about the filmmaker reclaiming the movies and going back to North Carolina where they were made and revisiting all the people who made it with him and all that kind of stuff. And then we did a featurette about the young guys who were the musicians who did the score, who both died very soon afterwards in a car accident. And then we put their score on the disc as well. So it's a very worthwhile disc.
Yeah.
And I just wish more people had got it.
Practically three movies, four if you count the documentary.
Yeah.
But it's a lot of stuff on there.
All right. There's a David Gregory anthology that I don't know if it ever got finished. Or if it's ever going to happen, or if I'm the only one who's ever going to see it.
That?
I don't even know what it's called anymore.
He's all smiles. Come on.
It used to be called Betamax.
It was called
Betamax.
I may have seen you working on it not too long
ago.
Yes,
exactly. So,
and some of the stories have changed too, right? Like some shorts have come in and out. And
so after we did Theatre Bizarre and then got into some legal issues with the distributor of that, we kind of missed the opportunity to do Theatre Bizarre 2 and 3.
Which sounded so good.
Which
were
very
two.
Much like in, you know, very much in development. Yeah. And then, of course, all the other – a million multi-director anthologies have subsequently come out. And so we decided to make one called Betamax, which was kind of a play on VHS, obviously. But the idea was to get sort of underground or outsider artists to make these, only give them a couple of $100 and make it in just a couple of weeks, have at it, come back with what you've got, and then we're going to – then that's going to be the film. We'll put it out on Intervision. And that
14
be
years later.
Exactly. Pretty much. And then Elric showed it at his festival.
Which was a lot of fun.
Which was pretty crazy because I remember I was shooting a short at the time and I was at Jim Koons' house using, I'll call it his murder hut.
He's got a weird murder hut.
It's like a smokehouse built into the side of a mountain. It's like stone
wall. Smokehouse for human flesh.
It's pretty creepy, but a lot of people use that for filming. So I was there shooting a short film and it right as Damon had just come off shooting his sequence.
Great Damon Packard.
And Jim was rushing to edit it to get it ready for Elric.
They were trying to finalize it on the I was already showing shorts that day and they're trying to finalize their thing that's going to show that night.
We were still shooting that day.
Right.
We were actually shooting inserts because we had Richard Stanley be the master of ceremonies.
And Richard Stanley, he had just left at this time or maybe he was still there but he was staying with somebody else because when I pulled up to Jim's there was literally this mountain of cigarettes out front and I was like, Jim, I didn't know you
smoked. No, he was still in town, but he left Jim's because he stayed at Jim's for a little while. But anyway, so we got the film ready in at least a presentable form to show your
underground film festival. And some of them were super finished and a couple seemed like they're still in motion.
Yes, exactly. And it was a really fun screening and
Beer was involved
and then nothing. And then basically one of the filmmakers was like, why the fuck is everybody else not finished though? I did my part of the bargain. So Scooter McRae took his film
which
out,
is a very good
which
short.
Which is a good short and he had every right to do that because he'd made this bloody film and it wasn't the rest of the film wasn't ready to go and it was also tonally very different from everything else in the film as
it
well
a little which bigger or
sometimes happens when you're doing an anthology like this you know you might come back and one really kind of sticks out but anyway he took his away no hard feelings or anything like that. He said go for it and then it just kind of languished for a while and I kept on talking to Mike Etal and Jim about how are we going to finish this film? This is stupid. We should put it out. Yeah. We've, gone to all this. We went to a certain amount of trouble to get it done. Yeah. Damon's is hilarious.
That's one of the funniest things I've ever seen. I'm not even joking.
It needs to be hilarious. Seen. So anyway,
John Carpenter's corpse is what it's called.
Carpenter's corpse. When he put John Carpenter's corpse in at some casting thing online, we got a letter the very next day from Carpenter's lawyers saying, you cannot call anything John Carpenter's something.
But Rotten Tomatoes have gone on record. It's a true story, according to them. So there's connection.
That's true.
It's still happening.
So anyway, that was another thing. We were like, we better get this out. God forbid, John Carpenter.
He won't. He'll never die. Don't worry.
Because it's not funny. It'll never happen. After that, you know. But anyway, so just a couple of months ago, Mike Etal came out. I got another short again from another film festival when it was doing Lost Soul, and which fits much more with the rest of it. And then we filmed, and then Mike Etal's filmed a witchcraft climax to the whole thing. And then just recently we were filming some more of the interstitial stuff to go between the shorts, which is kind of the Richard Stanley
the video store
opening
stuff,
video store stuff, and then it just all goes very surreal with the guy who's in it, who was in that part of it. And so, yeah, it's very, very close to completion. I'm just not going to tell you that it is actually
and,
coming out
anytime
soon. And
is that the kind of thing you will send to festivals, or will you just release it yourself? Do you know what you're going to try to do?
I don't, actually, because I want to see it all put together.
I feel like you put it on, like, I want you to release on one videotape that you just send someone. Yes. And if they put it into the world, I mean, it lives.
It deserves to be something like that. Yeah, I mean, you know how Damon did Reflections of Evil. I mean, it might wind up being something like that. Who knows? But
wait, doesn't Carpenter have restraints? Training order against him for a time.
He does.
If he doesn't, he will soon.
Is it still technically called Betamax, or is that still up for debate?
Up for debate. That's the working
title.
Wow. Yeah.
So there's a lot that's in flux on the thing. We're obviously in no hurry to finish it, but I would like to see it out there. And I'm pretty sure it'll be this year.
There's a lot of good stuff. I thought it was very entertaining. Yeah. Like, and I can't even remember all of them now. Yeah. They kind of blend
together. Well, by the time you see it, it'll be a completely different film. Yeah. So.
All different. Damon's is still good. In there.
Yes. Yeah.
And were you, correct me if I'm wrong, but were you going to re-release The Theater Bazaar at some point?
Yes.
Did those rights come back
to
you?
Yes, so we did manage to get the rights back from the thieving bastards who licensed it.
You could make a sequel then.
So we can make a sequel, but I think that, you know, that ship has sailed, honestly.
I think it depends on how, like, your original pitch for the part two, I think that would still fly.
Oh, my gosh, with the international.
It was Grand Guignol, and you had a lot of really interesting female directors attached at the time. Yeah. So I think if you still gave it another spin, I think you wouldn't matter.
Yeah, I would love to, but me and the French co-producer, we do talk about it from time to time, but I don't think it's anyone's priority at this point. But, once we will bring the Blu-ray out of the first one, again, sometime this year.
Yeah.
Beautiful. Yeah. And, let's talk a little bit about what you like as a fan these days, both modern movies and are there any discs from some of the other – I know it's weird because you're constantly putting out your own material, but are there other discs from some of the other companies that you've been really impressed with or just happy to buy as a fan?
Other discs from other companies. I probably don't watch enough of them to be able to comment on what's been out in recent months. Mm-hmm. I mean, I hear this Suspiria is amazing, but I haven't seen it. I work with Joe from Vinegar Syndrome all the time and Lewis from Massacre Video as well. So, and then I swap stuff with the guys from Shout Factory. So
I guess
but the last time we did a swap I got Tales from the Crypt Vault of Horror and Ninja 3. So like they're not recent releases.
What about New Horror? Like, are you paying attention to Autopsy of Jane Doe or things like that come out?
I liked Autopsy of Jane Doe. Yeah. I liked, Killing of Sacred Deer was probably my favorite movie last year. That was the big one for me. I actually went to the day I went to see Get Out, I also went to see the Shape of Water, the Feeling of Wellness. Is that what it's called?
Cure for Wellness.
And I really liked it.
Really?
Yeah, I thought it was really good.
You were cool I thought it was like an hour too long.
Yes, it was. It was a little. It was too big for what it was. Yeah, it wasn't even the length. It was the fact that there was just so much massive production value on the whole thing that I thought if it had been dialed back some, it would have been a really good movie.
It's got a good moment. And towards the end, it goes kind of
blunted.
Popcorn, with the weird.
Absolutely.
You know,
it's Phantom of the Opera, isn't it?
That was really my reading. Yes. Yeah. I thought everything about it works except that it's an hour too long. It's just like there's too much of it. There's something
but to see the two of those as a double feature was actually a great double feature because then we saw something that was like a small horror movie that worked, on pretty much every level. Mm-hmm. And then that one just had like just such crazy ideas in it, that it was like it's fun to see something that's big budgeted that has just such wacky ideas going on. And but like you say, it could have done with being reeled in just a little bit in terms of, how tight it was, because it was really like, okay, gore, go off and make whatever movie you want and then come back and do a pirates movie.
Do you think a horror film wins an Oscar this year? Does it happen? Does Get Out win an Oscar?
I don't care.
I don't care about the Oscars.
I I'll watch it and I'll sit there and get really fucking angry and all that kind of thing. But it's never been a barometer of quality.
Yeah, yeah.
And in fact, often quite the opposite. Hence the nominations for 3 billboards.
I learned today, I did not realize this about the Razzies, which I have just zero interest in, but I did not realize that Kubrick got a Razzie nom for The Shining. I mean, how crazy is that? Yeah. Like, for worst
film. But it's very similar to the best film. Like, if you look back on the history of nomination,
historically,
the best film.
Yeah, there's always been coincidental ones like that where, like, you see something that becomes classic was also nominated for a Razzie or sometimes, like Three Buildings.
So many good movies.
Ridiculous.
Yeah. We're not, anyway. So nothing, no new movie particularly to think everyone should go see. Killing a Sacred Deer.
Yeah, Killing of a Sacred Deer would be it, for sure.
But see, I read it as a black comedy more than a horror. Like,
I thought it was hilarious. It's one of the funniest things I've seen. So is Get Out, isn't it? So, I mean, it's... but, yeah, it was fun to see it the second time at Beyond Fest because then I got to just really giggle the whole way through the thing, whereas the first time I'm like, where is this taking me?
Yeah, because the tone is so different.
You know, and the Lobster by the same guy, I liked for the first half, and then it lost me because that style of acting... isn't conducive to, you know, having empathy for the characters.
Right.
It's like you don't feel like you're watching real characters. But Killing of a Sacred Deer, because of the situation that they're put in, you can't help but think, what would you do in that situation?
And it has to be
you
cold.
You want to see how it plays out. And I thought it was really
good. And if anyone was snubbed of an Oscar, it's that kid, Barry Keoghan.
Because,
my God, that kid gives some just interesting performance in this
amazing
movie. And Alicia Silverstone. Anyway, good. That's good. Another plug for that movie that not enough people have seen yet.
Yeah.
We're all going to be in Texas together in May. But what's your next?
We're bringing Claudia Fragasso to Texas Fright Fair.
Oh, wow.
And Rosella Drudy. Rosella Drudy writes all of Claudia Fragasso's movies, and they wrote a bunch of movies for Bruno Mattei before Fragasso went on and did his own movies like Troll 2 and Zombie 4 and stuff.
I wonder
like
if we could get him for a little interview while we're there. Like,
I'm sure
that'd be fine.
That would be fine.
Why not?
But we're releasing Shocking Dark, which was also known as The Terminator 2.
That is Steven Scarlatta's one of his favorite movies.
I've been waiting for that for a while.
So we're doing Shocking Dark and a couple of more that we I can't announce yet. But we'll have new Fragasso Blu-rays when we bring him to Texas Frightmare.
And by Texas Frightmare, Changeling
should be out by then as well.
Wow.
So, but you don't have a firm date yet, so that one's still...
I think it'll be end of April, but we haven't set the exact date
So maybe April.
Yeah.
So it'll be April or May, put it that way.
Yeah. And is that your next convention, or when else can people find you?
We'll be at Monsterpalooza, we'll be at Cinema Wasteland, we'll be at... what's the one in New Jersey? I don't know.
Monster Mania.
Yes, Monster Mania.
Where's Wasteland? Is that Ohio?
Wasteland's Ohio.
People are saying we should go to
that. Yeah, we've always
Wasteland's,
to do
Wasteland's
that
great. It's not huge like Texas Frightmare, but it's very, very passionate. And it's all crushed into this Holiday Inn of everybody. It's kind of like the bar at a heavy metal show or something. It's, the whole thing is like that.
And who hasn't dreamed of seeing Ohio?
Yeah, well, it's in it. It's not. It's even Strongburg, Strongsville, Ohio, something like that. So it's not. Yeah. So it's not. There's nothing else around. There's just. But the Holiday Inn get into it.
And they, sweet.
You know, they're really. And there's just sort of parties going on the whole time. It's a small convention, but like I say, it's always packed with very passionate horror fans.
We've had a lot of requests to go there.
BJ and Zach in there. That would be fun. Maybe we should do that this year.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
if it's not too late.
Thank you so much, David, for joining us.
Yeah, that was a good fun.
For a great chat. And obviously, if you guys see Severin Films at one of these conventions, say hello to David. Let him know you heard him on this show.
Yeah.
Indeed. And yes, let's buy some copies of Axe and Kidnap Coeds, as well as Bag Boy Lover Boy. Let's see.
And if you happen to
work.
Be a saxophonist, I want to know how realistic the playing in this movie is, because I would love to know.
The Devil's Honey, how realistic?
The Devil's Honey.
Maybe we'll share another clip, but we should sell a few more Devil's Honeys, I hope.
Yeah, it's magical. And Burial Grounds. Yeah.
And Threads and Eaten Alive are annual releases.
Threads. Can't wait. Thank you, David, and
Thanks
we'll see
so
you guys
much,
next
David.
Week.
Cheers.
Thank you.